Chapter 11. Sophomoric sophomore year, Ed Koliani and I were assigned to Kirkland House. We had a double, a sitting room, a bedroom with two bunk beds, and a bathroom. Oddly, the bathroom was between the other two rooms. You couldn't get into or out of the bedroom if it was in use. When the original Harvard houses, including Kirkland, were built in the 1930s, there were odd rooms here and there to house the richer students' live-in servants. The Kirkland dining room was far superior to the freshman union, smaller, of course, but also more personal. Within a couple of weeks, the kitchen staff lady who checked us off her list knew us all by name. "Good afternoon, Mr. Press." The staff were Irish women and referred to us as young gentlemen. The older ladies were in front, serving. The younger and prettier girls were back in the kitchen. Perhaps this segregation was to avoid tempting the young gentlemen with pretty Irish lasses, or vice versa, or perhaps the women with seniority got the easier jobs in front. Either way, the gulf in social class between the students and the staff was glaring and overt. Coming from relatively classless Southern California, I found it hard to get used to. It was old Harvard's real-life version of upstairs-downstairs. Sophomores were not usually hired by the math department as graders, but I filled out the application form anyway and was called in to interview with Dr. Arvison, the head section man for Math 21. Arvison was later, and for many years, professor of mathematics at UC Berkeley. The new course had expanded from 3 sections the previous year to 10 now, and he was desperate for graders. Maybe just to keep a close eye on my work. He hired me to grade his own section of 30 students. I enjoyed grading. The students didn't know that they were being graded by a skinny sophomore who had taken the course only the previous year. I quickly learned to recognize fake proofs, where a student would write down a series of true statements, the last of which was what was supposed to be proved, but the statements were not connected by any chain of logical reasoning that I could discern. In an early problem set, students were asked to use the field order axioms to prove that 1 is greater than 0. One student did everything right, but wrote as the last line, "Therefore 1, 0, which we know it is." I took off 1 point for the assertion that his intuition was somehow more meaningful than his correct proof. Dorm proctors doubled as academic advisors for freshmen, but advisors for sophomores and above were faculty in their major departments. My advisor was an assistant professor in physics, Dr. Snyder. Neither of us had the slightest interest in the other. I presented my study card listing the courses I intended to take. His signature was required. "Is that 1 too hard?" he said, pointing to Math 213, a graduate course. 5 words of advising. "No," I said, 1 word of rejecting his advice. In later semesters, I dispensed with Dr. Snyder entirely. Entering the physics building, I found the first occupied faculty office. I knocked, entered, waved my study card, and said cheerily, "Hi, remember me?" The professor had never seen me before, but he inevitably responded with something like, "Yes, of course I do. How are things going?" "Great," I said, providing no opening for any further conversation. Embarrassed at actually not remembering me, the professor simply signed and handed back my card. I can jump far forward in time now for a related story. As a Harvard professor, I signed the study card of a sophomore physics major, call her Miss C, in no less peremptory a fashion. She never returned. I assumed she either transferred out of physics or had a different advisor. More than 2 years later, I received a call from the senior tutor in one of the houses, call him Dr. Javert. It seemed that Ms. C had made it all the way to the final term of her senior year with no advisor at all. Every semester, she simply forged my signature on her study card. Now, she was already accepted into law school, not Harvard's. What Javert needed from me was a written statement confirming that the signatures were forgeries so that he could get her expelled from Harvard before she graduated. I refused. I saw her crime as victimless, and thanks to me, she graduated. I'm sure that she is a fine and resourceful lawyer somewhere. She may even know a little physics. Horace Lunt had joined the Harvard faculty in 1949 after finishing his PhD research with the celebrated Russian linguist and literary theorist Roman Jakobson. Lunt believed that Russian was best taught by surfacing its complicated linguistic regularities, that is, by memorizing complex linguistic rules instead of memorizing words and sentences. it is a debatable theory at best. Nevertheless, Slavic A, Harvard's first-year Russian course, was Luntz's legacy. The course was not for the faint of heart, but Ed Koliani had taken it as a freshman the year before, and Margaret, at Berkeley, had also mastered a first-year intensive Russian course, so I was motivated to give Slavic A a try. I had a romantic vision of Margaret and me in bed together, having sex and speaking Russian. Grammar sections were on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, attendance required. 4 hours a week of language labs, listening to tapes in Boylston Hall, were mandatory. Then, because the extremes of Luntz's anti-conversation vision had become blunted over time, we had a 2-hour conversation section, once a week in groups of six, with a native Russian speaker. Genry Yevrandovich was my conversation section man. He had a slim, athletic build and spoke no English at all. He was a professional acrobat and mime. He bounced around the classroom, jumped onto desks, grabbed objects and people, especially girls, and tried anything to get us to speak Russian. We eventually discovered that he wasn't a native Russian speaker at all. His mother tongue was Armenian, a completely unrelated language, and he had arrived just 3 months earlier from Italy, where he had been an extra and stunt double in the Italian film industry. The words, "Mamma mia," were frequent interpolations in his conversational Russian. Our 2 hours a week with him was a circus. My physics course was a disappointment. By contrast, my math course, a graduate-level course in complex variable theory taught by David Mumford, was difficult but rewarding. Mumford was a few years later awarded the Fields Medal, considered the highest honor in mathematics, and he went on to win a MacArthur Genius Fellowship, a Shaw Prize, and the National Medal of Science. I often spent more than 5 hours on his problem set of 5 problems, able to solve at most 3 of them. I audited Richard Brower's graduate course in real variable theory, a collection of jewels, theorems, actually, that he would take out of some hidden vault, polish, allow us to admire, and then return to the hiding place that would never be accessible to me. Brower had taught at Königsberg until Hitler came to power in 1933. He was one of the fortunate Jewish scientists brought to the U.S. by the Emergency Committee in aid of displaced foreign scholars. I briefly considered changing my major to math, but sanity prevailed. I was capable of appreciating higher mathematics, even taking courses in it, but I lacked the unique mathematical clarity of mind necessary to be able to produce it at a professional level. My Russian language course, Slavic A, was structured to weed out the weak and unfit in the first semester, and then second semester, to increase the challenge for the remaining Darwinian survivors. I was a survivor, but just barely. Every week I studied for many hours just to keep up, and spoiler alert, I put similar effort into Slavic B, second-year Russian, the whole next year. In Berkeley, Margaret's declared major was for a time Russian studies, although she eventually switched to linguistics. Several of our high school friends did major in Russian studies. Seen from today, it makes little sense. Why such interest in an arcane, difficult area of study? It is easy to forget today how bipolar the world was during the Cold War, especially so in the 1960s. In space, the Soviet Union was far ahead of the United States. The U.S. Apollo program was only just getting started. The Cuban Missile Crisis was a recent memory. Soviet science appeared equal to or better than American science in key disciplines, especially physics and applied mathematics. Globally, Russia dominated Eastern Europe and Central Asia, and Soviet influence was displacing the West's in the Mideast and South Asia. In Vietnam, we and the Soviets were fighting what amounted to a proxy land war. Studying Russian language was for liberals a way to extend a hand across the bipolar divide, and for conservatives, it was a prudent way to better know the enemy. So it was simultaneously a form of protest and an emblem of patriotism. In hindsight, all the effort that I put into studying Russian for 2 years yielded nothing except still gathering dust in my self-storage locker, an uncommon Cyrillic alphabet manual typewriter. It was all a wasted effort. But who could have known? If I didn't keep myself busy studying or at the radio station, a kind of depression would set in. Over time, I came to recognize and adjust to a classic bipolar cycle, a few weeks on an even keel, then a few days of manic productivity, followed by a crash to some days of, I thought of it as loneliness, but its right name was clinical depression. Gradually, I got used to this, even holding in reserve challenging projects to do during the manic phases. I could always tell when a manic phase was about to crash. A certain kind of tingling feeling signaled that, typically 12 hours later, I would barely be capable of anything except staying in bed. Perhaps a contributing factor was my struggle to interpret or emit or react gracefully to social signals. On a bus to visit a high school friend at Bowdoin College, a very pretty freshman from Colby College sat next to me, and after she elicited that I was a Harvard man with a sofa in my Cambridge dorm suite, she was crawling all over me. She needed to visit Boston every weekend for an independent research project in primitive art, and she didn't have any friends there to put her up. I couldn't misinterpret this social signal, but I had no idea how to deal with it. I pushed her hands away and told her that I needed the time on the bus to study Russian perfective and imperfective verbs, which I proceeded to do. On another occasion, on an airplane, a girl asked to use my tray table, in addition to her own, so that she could lay out in front of me a selection of the many ID cards in her bulging wallet, including her driver's license. If there was a message in this, I was incapable of figuring out what it was. A smaller cloud, at this time only barely perceptible in the sky over our lives, was the Vietnam War. When I turned 18, I had registered for the draft with the Selective Service Board in Cambridge because my parents then lived in Cambridge. You didn't change draft boards if you or your parents moved. The initial assignment was permanent. It took my board 8 months to classify me at all, and then as a 2S student deferment. Their quota of inductees for the war was still small. On paper, I was a Cambridge resident, a townie going to Harvard. For a board of upstanding Cambridge citizens, that was something special. I estimated my chances of being drafted as close to zero. Chapter 12. Coursework. My physics course in the fall of my junior year was quantum mechanics, taught by Professor Norman Ramsey from his own detailed mimeographed notes. He had been teaching the course for decades. The lectures and notes were polished to a satin sheen. Any possible question was somewhere already answered in the written materials. Ramsey lectured in the booming voice of an Army drill instructor. In fact, he was raised as an Army brat. During World War II, his father was a brigadier general. Ramsey the Younger, my professor, was assigned to the Manhattan Project in the war and led the team that did the final assembly of the plutonium bomb on Tinian Island in 1945. When I told my father about my quantum mechanics professor, he laughed. He had taken exactly the same course from Ramsey as a graduate student at Columbia. Much, if not most, of modern experimental atomic physics in the United States traces to Norm Ramsey and his more than 80 PhD students. For years, he was the poster child example of a scientist whose influence was so finely woven into the fabric of science that no single discovery could be credited to him specifically, meaning that he could never win a Nobel Prize. The Nobel Committee proved this wrong in 1989 when he won the Physics Prize with a citation that focused on one tiny part of his legacy. They had to find something, since his not getting a Nobel had by then become a scandal. By this time, I had perfected a minimal effort approach to doing physics problem sets. If one knew where to look, one could find, somewhere on the shelves of the physics library, a worked solution to every problem that any instructor might ever think he was the first to invent. Old physics textbooks contained worked exercises, and there were books in most subfields of physics that collected problems and solutions as study guides for graduate student comprehensive exams, nicely arranged by topic. One particular journal for physics teachers, the American Journal of Physics, with bound volumes going back to 1933, was full of clever problems and solutions submitted by physics instructors, often from small colleges. An initial investment of my time was required before I became adept at finding things in this literature, but after that, I did all my problem sets by the library method, more than twice as fast as before. There was no reason not to be scrupulously honest about it. My every solution began with a disclaimer like, "This solution is based on AMJ-Phys Vol 19 P-374, or Batygin and Toptygin problems in electrodynamics Brakschak 4.23. No grader ever rejected my scholarly approach, a greater myself, I guessed that they were probably using my literature perfect solutions as models. For math, I took an undergraduate course in abstract modern algebra taught by Chi-Han Sa, an assistant professor who spent his later career at SUNY Stony Brook. This was an easy course, designed for that lower tier of Harvard math majors who would never become real mathematicians. But then, I wouldn't become one either. I learned little, retained over time even less, and got an A+, not actually a legal grade at Harvard, but Professor Sa's small ornamental salute. My elective course was Economics 1, a huge course supervised by Professor Otto Eckstein, who was later a member of President Johnson's Council of Economic Advisors. Economics was one of the largest majors at Harvard, and lectures were in Lowell Lecture Hall, Harvard's largest classroom. Most students in EC1 were freshmen who struggled with the math. I found the course easy and interesting enough that I started reading more advanced economics textbooks on my own. And then, of course, Slavic B. The Russian Orthodox saints must have smiled on me, because just that year, the course was revamped and made less rigorous, more conversational. It still required a lot of time studying, but it was not nearly the struggle that Slavic A had been. Marty Chalfie, a Werby who was rarely around the station because he was also on the swim team, was in my section. Much later, he won a Nobel Prize in chemistry for discovering that a green fluorescent protein isolated from jellyfish could be joined onto many kinds of biomolecules as a visible tracer, the enabling technology for literally thousands of subsequent discoveries in biology. I still had to earn my spending money. Fall term, I again graded Math 21 with the new wrinkle that instead of grading the individual papers, I was allowed to write out solution sets on purple Ditto masters that were duplicated and distributed to the class. I was never at a loss for good solutions, since I could crib the best solution among the papers submitted, exactly as I imagined my physics grader cribbing from me. I always included an acknowledgement to the student. Spring term, instead of grading, I applied to the Student Aid Office's Faculty Aid Program and was assigned to Professor Gerald Holton in the physics department. In practice, I barely met Holton, and instead worked for his postdoctoral student, Dr. Stephen Hawley, no relation to the similarly named astronaut. The pay was $1.50 an hour, significantly less than I made grading, but the job was more varied. In the 1940s, Holton had been the doctoral student of Percy Bridgman, a professor at Harvard who founded the field of high-pressure physics and was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1946. Bridgman, suffering from terminal cancer, committed suicide by gunshot in 1961. Holton inherited the remnants of Bridgman's high-pressure work, by this time housed in a single large room in the basement of Lyman Laboratory. That was where I worked. The equipment, hydraulic presses, etc., was all mechanical, and from the 1920s and 30s. After Albert Einstein's death in 1955, Holton had become involved in the curation and publication of the Einstein Archive, and he was also editor-in-chief of Daedalus, a highbrow intellectual journal. By the time I was a part of his lab, he had very little interest in high-pressure physics. I got to know Jerry Holton better later, when we were colleagues on the Harvard faculty. Born to a Jewish family in Vienna, he was fortunate to leave Austria in 1938 as part of the Kinder transport organized by British Quakers, and he emigrated to the United States 2 years after that. In the 1990s, Holton was regarded as a prominent historian and philosopher of science. His and Nina's cocktail soirees attracted a wide spectrum of Cambridge intellectuals. But when I worked in Holton's lab, postdoc Hawley's unenviable job was to try to squeeze publishable results out of ancient equipment and an actively uninterested mentor. My job, less unenviable, was computer programming and building electronics for Hawley's futile effort to modernize the lab. The electronics part took me back to my junior high school projects, but now, instead of taking the bus to Dow for parts, I could get, or special order, anything I wanted at the physics stockroom. Also, I didn't have to worry whether anything I built actually worked. Steve would hand me a schematic, circuit diagram. I would build the thing, taking as many hours as I liked at $1.50 per hour, and present him with the result. After that, it was his problem. He spent many hours with a soldering iron fixing my errors, but fewer than it would have taken him to build the things himself. I liked being a very junior experimental physicist, but in truth, I had very little talent for it. Margaret and I wrote to each other much less than before, not because we thought ourselves any less committed, but because we could see the light at the end of the tunnel of our separation from each other. Two lights, in fact. We were planning to spend the summer in Europe. My parents had agreed to let me spend the $700 in a savings account that was my inheritance from my grandmother Nana. And, in Berkeley, Margaret was taking 6 courses. If she passed them all, she could graduate a year early and move to Cambridge for my senior year. The times had changed enough that we could contemplate overtly living together off campus, if Harvard would allow it. The college's strict rule was that all undergraduates should live in the Harvard houses. House life was a required part of the undergraduate experience. For those of a certain lofty social class, a year off for foreign travel was also supposed to be part of the Harvard experience. However, fewer students than usual were taking whole years off. The reason was Vietnam. If you were not a full-time student, you were liable to be drafted. The residential houses were thus overcrowded, and a small number of seniors were therefore being allowed to live off campus. Kirkland House's quota was 20, the selection to be made by Master Smithies and his wife. Mrs. Smithies had certain peculiarities. On Friday afternoons, when girls from Wellesley and Smith were streaming into Kirkland House with their little pastel suitcases for illegal weekend stays with their jock boyfriends, Mrs. Smithies liked to stand outside on a little balcony of the master's residence that overlooked the Kirkland portal and call out to the girls, "Whores, you are all whores." I wasn't sure that she would be sympathetic to my request to live off campus with Margaret, whom I carefully described as my fiancé. My Slavic B experience ended with a peculiar twist. After I took the final exam and was completely done, I received a note from Miss Ketchian asking me to come to her office at a specified time. From the far side of her desk, she said, "I'm having trouble deciding whether to give you a B+ or an A- for your course grade." She hadn't asked me a question, so I didn't say anything. She continued, "Are you thinking of taking third-year Russian in the fall?" I wasn't, but I was not clear about how I should answer. "What's the right answer?" I finally said. She said, "If you were thinking of continuing in Russian, then I would have to give you a B+ to discourage you. But if this is your terminal course, then I can give you an A." My answer was obvious. On June 13th at commencement, I watched from the WHRB broadcast area on the steps of Widener Library as Harvard awarded an honorary degree to the Shah of Iran, with the later, after he was deposed, ironic citation, "a ruler who has found in power a constructive instrument to advance social and economic revolution." Margaret flew to Boston that same day. On June 15th, we flew from New York to Luxembourg on a cheap charter flight. Leasing for 3 months a tiny Renault, we drove through Switzerland, Austria, Germany, Denmark, Belgium, and the Netherlands, staying in small hotels and pensions, often the ones recommended in Frommer's Europe on $5 a day. London, however, made the biggest impression. We hung out in Trafalgar Square and at Piccadilly Circus. This was the 1968 London of Carnaby Street, Yellow Submarine, Twiggy, Mick Jagger, and David Bowie, none of whom we actually saw. Theater tickets were cheap, and we saw West End musicals with British actors in the canonical American roles. Alfie Bass, not Zero Mostel, in Fiddler on the Roof, Keith Michelle, not Richard Kiley, in Man of La Mancha, and the musical theater debut of a young Shakespearean actress named Judi Dench as Sally Bowles in Cabaret. We drove north to Hadrian's Wall, where a mistaken note was left on our windshield in the parking lot, "Un bonjour de deux Français de passage." Our Renault had French plates, in those days still rarely seen in Scotland. We drove south through the Lake District to Stonehenge. There was then no fence around the monument, and it swarmed with tourists climbing on the big stones, homier and different from today's austere, distant preservation. At the end of August, we returned the car in Paris, took the bus to Luxembourg, and our charter flight home. There was good news waiting for us. Master and Mrs. Smithies had approved my application to live off campus with Margaret in Sin for my senior year. Indeed, the times they were a-changin'. Chapter 13. Professors. We rented a one-bedroom apartment at 335A Harvard Street, a four-story brick apartment building just five blocks from the Harvard Yard. Margaret was admitted by MIT's linguistics department as a non-degree special student, allowing her to take graduate courses and, not incidentally, pay full tuition. The MIT department was ground zero for the worldwide explosion of interest in Noam Chomsky's theory of transformational generative grammar. Margaret took a course taught by Morris Holley, Chomsky's longtime collaborator. My sole physics course was titled Advanced Quantum Mechanics, but it was really something else entirely. Professor Julian Schwinger was Harvard's most famous theoretical physicist. In 1965, while I was a freshman, Schwinger was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics, shared with Richard Feynman and the Japanese physicist Shinichiro Tomonaga. This was the first time in the prize's history that the award was made purely for a theoretical construct, the theory of quantum electrodynamics, QED. Schwinger was a former child prodigy who had received his PhD at age 21. In 1949, he and Feynman independently proposed what seemed to be two competing theories of QED, but within a year they were shown by Freeman Dyson to be exactly equivalent, just couched in different mathematics. Many thought that Dyson should have shared the prize, but it can be divided at most three ways. We will see much more of both Richard Feynman and Freeman Dyson later on. The two decades following were not kind to Schwinger's approach. Feynman's QED was intuitive, graphical, so-called Feynman diagrams, and easy to calculate. Schwinger's approach required long and intricate manipulations of symbols and equations. Feynman, a larger-than-life character, was lionized, Schwinger, marginalized. People said that Schwinger could have joined the mainstream. He could have applied his universally acknowledged, especially by himself, genius to further important discoveries. What he did instead was to withdraw from communication with colleagues, resign from professional societies, and devote himself to a body of work, essentially a reformulation of all of modern physics, all premised on a counterfactual history where his approach to QED, and not Feynman's, had carried the day. He called this work source theory. Schwinger's lectures were journeys to another planet, his own. Everything the man did was theatrical. He entered the lecture hall in Jefferson Lab on the dot of the hour, walked slowly, slightly hunched over, as if carrying the weight of all physics on his shoulders. He gave no greeting to the class. He went to the blackboard, straightened powerfully as if infused with a sudden jolt of energy, reached with his chalk to the upper left corner of the board as if gesturing to heaven, and without ever consulting notes of any kind, proceeded to dispense elegant equations across all the blackboards. Every word of every lecture was perfect. It was as if, and probably was, from a memorized script. It was the direct word of God, no, better than God, of Schwinger. It was a completely useless course, not actually physics at all in any meaningful sense. It was pure performance art. It was mesmerizing. Once started, his lectures paid no attention to the clock. A lecture might go for its assigned hour, or for half an hour into overtime. True art has its own pace. Later in life, I encountered a number of people who, like me, took Schwinger's course in these years. Remembering, we could all only shake our heads in simultaneous admiration and disbelief. My mother told the story of meeting Mrs. Schwinger in the Belmont Fish Market. Billy would not have recognized Mrs. Schwinger, who was known to be Professor Schwinger's former secretary, except that the well-dressed woman was charging the fish purchase to her account by name. You could do that then. My mother introduced herself as the wife of Frank Press, the MIT professor. MIT, Mrs. Schwinger sniffed, ending the conversation. MIT was no Harvard. In his career, Schwinger had 73 PhD students, four of whom won Nobel Prizes. Schwinger left Harvard in 1972 at the age of 54 for UCLA, where, it was said, he was given priority to use any tennis court at any time. His office in Lyman Lab, wood-paneled and beautifully furnished, was inherited by Steven Weinberg, a younger field theorist. Weinberg claims that Schwinger left in the office a pair of old shoes with the clear meaning, "So you think you can fill these, sonny boy." It was made easier for Weinberg to tell this story by the fact that he was himself awarded the Nobel Prize in 1979, and among acknowledged great physicists is widely considered the greater of the two. Professor William Alfred's course in Anglo-Saxon poetry was even less useful to my career in physics than Schwinger's source theory. Still, I jumped at the chance to take it. Seniors got favorable positions in the lottery for its limited enrollment, and there were no prerequisites. That year, he was more famous than usual. His play Hogan's Goat, starring Faye Dunaway, had just closed on Broadway after running 607 performances. The first half of the course, English 200A, was in effect a foreign language course with grammar drills and vocabulary lists to memorize. Knowing English and high school German, I found Anglo-Saxon pretty easy to pick up. We didn't have to speak it, no Jenry Yavrandovich here, just be able to read and translate. When we had the basics of the language down, we started reading the limited Anglo-Saxon literature, an anthology of shorter poems for the rest of the first term. Then English 200B, a full semester on Beowulf. We were assigned exactly 100 lines to prepare for each class. Alfred quickly learned our names and called on us individually to translate the next few lines as idiomatically as we dared. He must have known by heart all 3,000 lines of Beowulf. Each few lines would bring to his mind amusing stories to recount, sometimes illuminating of the text, but more often irrelevant. Kittredge, he told us, said of the Fairy Queen that every time Spenser took a drink, he changed the allegory. Alfred had a stock of stories about F.P. Magoon, a preeminent Harvard scholar of the previous generation, who Alfred claimed with a straight face was the model for the cartoon character Mr. Magoo. Magoon taught a famously easy gut course, Anglo-Saxon poetry in translation. Alfred's stories about him were often structured around a dim question by a student athlete in the front row, producing an unlikely eccentric answer by Magoon. Professor, if the Danes drank kumis, fermented mare's milk, then why did the Saxons drink mead, fermented honey? Because there were more bees than horses. When called on to translate, I was usually prepared, but I learned quickly that I shouldn't waste the class's time if I wasn't. I'm not prepared, I would say, and with a brief, mournful look, Alfred would go on to the next student. I got an A both semesters. I took an applied math course in function theory taught by Bernard Budiansky, one of Harvard's distinguished cohort of applied mathematics professors. This had a lot of overlap with the complex variable course that I had taken as a sophomore, so it was easy. But let me jump out of time here for another piece of Harvard history. There existed at Harvard a rich vein of applied mathematics centered on complex variable and analytic function theory, for which the place was world famous in its applications to engineering and physics. Professors George Carrier, Bernard Budiansky, Max Crook, and Tai-Tsun Wu were in my time the core group of faculty in this field. They rotated among themselves the duties of teaching the advanced courses, two of which I took. This was a field both beautiful intellectually and immediately applicable to practical problems. Harvard graduated many PhD and hired outstanding junior faculty in the area. Carrier et al. Flourished as, in effect, a small, autonomous department. Carrier was himself awarded the National Medal of Science in 1990. But by the mid-1990s, the field was not the same. Its applications could be better attacked by comparatively brute-force computer calculations, the more so as the sophistication of the computer methods improved. As they successively retired, Carrier et al. Pressed for Harvard to replace them with younger scholars like themselves, deeply analytic mathematicians. These appointments were vetoed by one single-minded individual, Paul Martin, who had been made Dean of Applied Science, improbably because he was a theoretical physicist, a former student of Schwinger's, in fact. Harvard replaced its brilliant old applied mathematicians with young computational scientists, individuals who would have been only B students in Carrier's applied mathematics courses, but whose appointments opened up new fields. Over a generation, Martin's stubbornness became vindicated. Fields of science have an arc. They are born, they grow, they flourish, they wither, and at some point they must die or be killed off by an authoritarian dean. Back to my senior year as an undergraduate, I took an astronomy course in stellar structure and evolution, taught by a young, high-strung, and very green assistant professor, Richard McCrae. There were fewer than a dozen of us in the course, including, as it would turn out, two future Harvard professors of astronomy, myself and Bob Kirshner, and a future Princeton professor of astronomy, Rich Gott. For me, a physics major, McCrae's course was my first introduction to theoretical astrophysics, a seed that later sprouted. A less fertile seed for the companion field of observational astronomy was planted by my fellow student Ken Betches, later an astronaut, who as an astronomy major was allowed to check out the key for the 9-inch Alvin Clark refractor telescope on the roof of the observatory, the Historical Astronomy Department building. I spent a few cold nights with him trying to locate known asteroids that, when you found them, were just points of light. From our low hill on Garden Street, surrounded by the lights and turbulence of Boston, Jupiter and Saturn were no more than blurry, dancing images. My observational seed never sprouted. Bob Kirshner's did, and he became a famous observer with many discoveries and prizes. About him, more later. We students beat up on McCrae mercilessly. If he handed out a problem set in class, we inspected it and told him which problems we didn't like and wouldn't do. I was often point man for this negotiation. He inevitably caved. He was not used to the assertiveness of Harvard upper-level undergraduates. This was exactly how Harvard trained us to be. The last thing McCrae's career needed was a public rebellion by the students in his assigned class. We sensed his weakness and exploited it. Of course, I got an A. McCrae became one of the top theoretical astrophysicists of his generation. He was proud of the fact that so many of us in his first teaching experience did so well later on. I had two term-time jobs now. I was grading a section of 46 students in Math 1, the most elementary calculus course. The pay had risen to $6 per student per semester. My other job was continuing to work for an increasingly demoralized Steve Hawley in Professor Holton's basement lab. I spent a few hours a week doing his computer work, for the good of all concerned. My career of building electronics was on hold. But there was by now very little pretense that I was being paid to do anything at all. I was there to give the absent Professor Holton the illusion of supporting a worthy student, and to give his postdoc the illusion that his career was not completely in the toilet. I tried hard to fulfill these expectations. My concurrent career as a computer criminal began in the Holton lab. Computing, not just at Harvard but everywhere, was on the cusp of an epochal change. Harvard had acquired a Scientific Data Systems SDS-940 computer, one of about 60 made. Overnight, the experience of computing was completely different. Before the change, you key-punched your program on IBM cards, brought the deck to the Aiken Computer Center window, and came back hours later for a long program the next day to pick up your cards and the printed results. There were usually bugs to correct. With luck, you could get in a few runs a day. After the change, you sat at a teletype terminal in a room full of terminals. You were communicating with the computer in real time, and even more extraordinary, the other people in the room were communicating with the same computer at the same time. If your program had bugs, you could correct them in minutes, not hours. You could even have more than one program running at the same time. This was so-called time sharing. I convinced Hawley that I should move all the lab's data analysis from the IBM to the SDS. Holton had no interest in this, but Hawley had managed to secure a minuscule grant to support his own research, independent of his mentor. My account on the time-sharing system was charged to this grant. I now spent many hours in the Aiken Terminal Room instead of at WHRB. Moving the lab's data analysis to the new machine was straightforward. I spent much more terminal time probing the internals of the machine and teaching myself to program in the computer's underlying machine language. One night, the whole machine crashed. When it came back up a few minutes later, I happened to look at our account information, and I saw that I had not been charged for the several hours I had been working. Accounting was being done by the system's logout program. The operating system was designed so that no single user could crash the whole machine, but it had never occurred to the designers that users might want to crash their own sessions. I wrote a small program in machine language to do that. From then on, instead of logging out in the normal way, I ran my little program, crashed my session, and avoided Hawley's having to pay anything. This was a slippery slope. Once computing was, in effect, free, I could in good conscience invite my Werby friends to be hackers, not yet a recognized word, with me. Initially, we were all using the same Holly account, taking care to accrue no actual charges. We soon discovered a different system flaw, one that let us read the passwords of anyone who logged into the machine. A breakthrough came when we happened to collect the password of a privileged account, one with the power to create new accounts. We created a slew of free accounts for ourselves, thinking that they would be lost among the hundreds of existing usernames. This was naive, as it turned out. Over Christmas, staying with Margaret's parents in Pasadena, Tommy Lauritsen told me that I was almost certain to be admitted to Caltech's physics PhD program. I had, mostly, A's from Harvard. I had taken my graduate record exams and gotten high scores. But even more important, I had letters of recommendation from Ed Purcell and Norm Ramsey. Purcell actually knew me and likely said good things. For Ramsey, I was just one of 100 students in his quantum mechanics class. He wrote dozens of upbeat pro forma recommendations every year. Tommy told me that the letters' routine nature didn't lower their value. No matter how superficial were Ramsey's recommendations, his Caltech colleagues believed that, somehow, he wouldn't send them a bad apple. I hadn't definitely decided to go to Caltech. It depended on where Margaret got into a linguistics PhD program. She had applied to UCLA, which was within commuting distance of Caltech. But if we both got into MIT, we might stay in Cambridge. Around this time, I learned about a high-paying graduate fellowship awarded nationally to a few students in physics by the little-known Fannie and John Hertz Foundation. I had never heard of this foundation before, and their awards could be used only at a list of 10 schools, but both Caltech and MIT were on the list, so I applied. This proved to be a fateful event that, as we will see, set the course of much of my later life. I thus wish I could remember who pointed me to Hertz or how I learned of their existence. It may have been as random as seeing a poster on a physics department bulletin board. In 1657, Edward Hopkins, an early governor of Connecticut, died and bequeathed to Harvard a small sum to give some encouragement unto those foreign plantations for the breeding up of hopeful youth in the way of learning. By the time I was at Harvard, his bequest had become a prize, awarded every year to some dozens of sophomores from foreign plantations, the list of which included California. This very minor prize consisted of a single book chosen by each prize winner and embossed on its title page with the Harvard seal. The prize was called a debtor, after the Latin detur digniori, translated as to the worthier let it be given. My sophomore grades qualified me for a debtor. I was a junior by the time Harvard got around to asking me what book I wanted. I had recently read somewhere a favorable review of The Diaries and Letters of Harold Nicholson, Volume 1, and asked for that. In quite a different way from my discovery of the Hertz Foundation, this was another fateful event. It is hard to imagine anyone in modern history with whom I have less in common than with the British diplomat and aristocrat Harold Nicholson, 1886 to 1968. Though he later recanted, he was an early supporter of Oswald Mosley and British fascism. In private, he was rabidly anti-Semitic. He was homosexual and married to Vita Sackville West, herself a lesbian and the lover of author Virginia Woolf. Harold and Vita were devoted to each other in an asexual way, quite different from my excellent relationship with Margaret. Harold was, on and off, an MP in the House of Commons, and he knew everyone in British politics from the 1930s through 1950s. His diary is one of the great English-language diaries. Not as good as Pepys, surely, but for me in a class with Boswell and, another of my favorites, Anne Morrow Lindberga. I loved Volume 1. By the time I was a senior, Volumes 2 and 3 had been published, and I devoured them too. Nicholson died in May 1968. At that time, I fully intended to have a life as interesting as Nicholson's, even if it did not include hobnobbing with Winston Churchill, Charles de Gaulle, and the Bloomsbury literati. It was thus inevitable that I should, on January 1, 1969, in the middle of my senior year at Harvard, start my own diary. I typed daily entries directly into Final Copy, no editing allowed, for the next 20 years. It became a reflexive habit, producing about 100,000 words a year, a good novelistic length. Why I stopped in the middle of typing a sentence in August 1990 is a story to be saved for later. Chapter 14, Graduating. Three things were important to me in my final undergraduate semester: computer hacking, radio station WHRB, internal politics, and getting into graduate school with a good fellowship. Classwork, a fourth, barely registered on my radar. Events that turned Harvard upside down, climaxing with the forcible student occupation of the main administration building, University Hall, and a violent early morning storming of the building by police in riot gear, these registered as important to me only through the lens of WHRB, or through the minor inconveniences of working around them. WHRB friends Paul Perkovich, Steve Wilner, and Ed Belove were my main partners in crime as computer hackers. After his graduation, in the early 1970s, Ed worked for Data General Corporation, a time and place described in Tracy Kidder's book, Soul of a New Machine. He was then an early hire to visionary Mitch Kapor's Lotus Development Corporation. Computer security was in its infancy. As undergraduate criminals, we discovered exploits that much later we read about in textbooks, independently discovered by others. One was later to become famous as the buffer overrun vulnerability. We figured out that if you entered the username 100bb.set1.xxxmtswh.oauth, you would be instantly connected as an invisible user with the highest level of security privileges. After some weeks, the system's source code, which existed on a magnetic tape in the computer machine room, was patched to eliminate this vulnerability. But by then, we had overwritten half a dozen pieces of system software with our own Trojan backdoors, those actual terms then unknown, and we copied our modified versions onto Harvard's master system source code tape. We were pretty good, but not by any means as good as the best. In his later 1984 Turing Award lecture, computer scientist Ken Thompson defined four levels of hacker ability. The lowest level of skill involves merely injecting malware into a running computer. The next level, which we achieved, injects it into the source code for the computer's operating system. The level after that, which we missed, injects malware into source code for the compiler program of the computer's source code so that even a fully checked program will compile to an infected binary. Finally, Thompson noted that the compiler itself is used from time to time to compile new versions of itself. So, the loftiest level of exploit, which we never could have imagined, was to inject a Trojan into the compiler's source code, compile the compiler, and then delete the malware from source code everywhere. Malware would now be injected into the binary of anything that the compiler compiles, including itself. Yet even a line-by-line security check of the compiler's and all other source code will find nothing amiss. If not in any source code, then where in cyberspace, a word coined only in 1984 by science fiction writer William Gibson, does your exploit exist? If a tree falls in a forest? This idea of self-reproducing machine code is worth wrapping your head around. Computer Center staff were actively pursuing us, but they didn't know our real-life identities. Avoiding getting caught became more difficult when we discovered that we were not alone in hacking the Harvard computer's innards. There was someone else, a bumbling amateur, messily discovering for himself the most elementary exploits. We called him the interloper. We cleaned up after him whenever possible, but he was persistent and unsubtle. Ultimately, we decided to track him down and turn him in to the authorities. I wish I could say that we caught the interloper in some clever way. The truth was that a friend overheard a visitor to Kirkland House bragging about his computer hacks. This was obviously our guy. "I know some people who really want to talk to you," our friend said to him. His name was Jeff Ellman, a senior, a history major, in Elliott House. A few days later, we met with him in a midnight meeting. It turned out that Ellman wasn't by nature a computer hacker at all. He was an accomplished phone freak. Some background. It was legend at WHRB that in the early 1960s, Warby's Charlie Pine, Tony Locke, and Ed Ross were the original phone freaks. Hackers who brought the Bell telephone system to its knees by uncovering systemic engineering weaknesses that allowed just about anyone with a bit of technical knowledge to make free long-distance calls. That group was tracked down by the FBI and arrested. Ironically, their phones had been tapped. None of the Warby phone freaks were ever actually convicted, unlike their West Coast counterpart John Draper, known as Cap'n Crunch, a friend of Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak, who served time in Lompoc Prison and later worked for Apple. the original Werby's notes and diagrams were impounded by the FBI. However, copies and reconstructions circulated underground. How Jeff Ellman came into possession of materials and expertise that originated with the original WHRB phone freaks is a story told in Phil Lapsley's 2013 book, Exploding the Phone, The Untold Story of the Teenagers and Laws Who Hacked Mabel, forward, not coincidentally, by Steve Wozniak, in which Ellman is given the pseudonym Jake Locke. Later in his life, Ellman was chair of its Department of Cognitive Sciences, then Dean of Social Sciences, at UC, San Diego. Back in 1969, we didn't turn Ellman in, but the authorities soon caught him on their own. He was brought up on disciplinary charges and put on academic probation. That caused us to moderate our own hacking exploits considerably. The penalties, if caught, were now too great. I knew that with my Harvard grades, my recommendations from Professors Ramsey and Purcell, and my GRE scores, I would get into any physics graduate school I applied to. The uncertainty lay in where Margaret could get into a linguistics PhD program and whether we would get fellowships enough to support us in two-student married life. My parents had made clear that their financial support ended with my bachelor's degree. I applied to Caltech and MIT, Margaret to MIT and UCLA. MIT started trying to recruit me some weeks before they were supposed to, by agreement among graduate schools. Larry Rosenson, a physicist whom I had worked for at MIT the summer before my junior year, was chair of their admissions committee. He invited me to visit him at his office and took the occasion to award me, orally and also jumping the deadline, MIT's Carl Compton Fellowship. A couple of weeks later, I had to call Rosenson to say that Margaret had been rejected a second time by MIT's linguistics program and that Caltech now seemed our more likely destination. Shortly after that, Margaret did receive her acceptance by UCLA and a small fellowship. Caltech admitted me, but was cagey about financial support. Tommy Lauritsen unofficially told me that they were certain that I would win an outside fellowship. I had applied for several. Their certainty did little to counter my uncertainty. After applying for the lucrative Hertz Foundation Fellowship, I had never heard back from the Hertz people, not a peep. Early one afternoon, Steve Hawley interrupted my paid reverie in the Holton basement lab with the news that the office in Berkeley of Professor Edward Teller, the Hungarian-American physicist universally known as the father of the H-bomb, was trying to reach me. I ran to a phone. Teller's secretary told me to fly to New York City right away, today, and go immediately to the Hertz Foundation's hotel suite at the American Physical Society annual meeting. They would reimburse me. This was my first introduction to how Hertz operated as the personal extension of Edward Teller and a small circle of his disciples, whom I would soon know well. Margaret came with me. At the Hertz Hotel Suite in New York, confusion. They had never heard of me. They accepted my word that Dr. Teller had sent me. They found someone to interview me, a physicist named Hudgens. His first question was, "How would you calculate the temperature inside an exploding hydrogen bomb?" His second question was, "I don't want you to think that this is a loaded question, but what do you think about student activism?" If there was a third question, I don't remember it. It didn't bode well. Margaret, meanwhile, had at the physics meeting located Professor Fay Eisenberg-Selov, a colleague of her father's and close friend of her family. Fay was born in Berlin in 1926 to a wealthy Jewish family. Her father providentially relocated the family to France in 1930 and, with again exquisite timing, to the U.S. via Lisbon in 1940, and he managed to get out with some family money both times. Fay and her husband Wally Selov were now both themselves well off. She took us to dinner at the Russian Tea Room, where we ate a lot of caviar but didn't see any celebrities. 2 days later, back in Cambridge, another call from Dr. Teller's office. I should go immediately to a certain room at MIT and be interviewed by Dr. Lowell Wood and Dr. Harry Solin. At least they had names this time. I rushed to Harvard Square and took the subway 2 stops to Kendall. This interview was no less peculiar than the first. Wood was a chubby young man with a Mephistophelian beard and matching manner. His laugh was a high-pitched cackle. Hearing that I might want to work with Kip Thorne at Caltech, he asked me some vague questions about gravitational collapse, cackling several times. Solin, an older man, by comparison morose, asked me how I might make a hologram movie. I had no idea. They were both friendly enough and encouraged me, with or without a Hertz fellowship, to apply for a summer job at Lawrence Livermore Lab, an offshoot of Lawrence Berkeley Lab, founded by Teller in 1952, where they were both staff scientists. I left with the LLL application forms, which I duly completed and mailed. There followed another radio silence from Hertz for 6 weeks. Just short of the Caltech's deadline for accepting their inferior fellowship offer, I got a telegram. I was awarded a fellowship. Details to follow, I doubted promptly. A week later, I got a thicker and much more business-like letter from the Livermore Employment Office offering me a summer job at $700 per month, a huge sum, plus moving expenses. My supervisors would be Dr. Edward Teller and Dr. Dive, Lowell Wood. Arthur Hudgens' question about student activism was prophetic, because a week later, on April 9th, the radical anti-war organization Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, invaded Harvard's University Hall, forcibly evicted the deans from their offices, and occupied the building. I rushed to WHRB, whose regular broadcasting was now preempted by full-time coverage of these events. An impromptu radical student assembly, meeting in the liberated, ornately decorated faculty room inside University Hall, had just voted to exclude all media from the building, except WHRB and the Harvard Crimson. The time that it took the Crimson to set up and print an edition was 6 hours, so we were de facto the only media pipeline. I was sent to University Hall to help secure our lines of communication. Some tough-looking SDSers were guarding the doors, but anyone who looked like a student was allowed to roam freely in and out. In many parts of the building, students had spray-painted slogans on the walls. Locked files were being broken into and rifled, with embarrassing financial records later to be published in the Mole Underground newspaper. WHRB had commandeered the office of Franklin Ford, the dean of the faculty. Via back-channel communication, we explained to Ford that we would keep his office physically safe in return for his continued availability to us as a news source. Of course, he agreed. From the dean's perspective, WHRB could serve perfectly as the administration's unofficial media outlet. So, remarkably, both sides of the conflict thought us useful to them. I helped string wires out the upper windows of University Hall and into adjacent freshman dorms, where we took over the rooms and telephone lines of students eager to help. Bob Luskin, anchored from Ford's office, cutting to reports from Chris Wallace and the others' newsies elsewhere in the building and on campus. I felt some vaguely paternal pride because Luskin had been a candidate in the comp the previous fall, of which I was comp director. He went on to become a Rhodes Scholar and later a federal prosecutor. Chris Wallace's future success in broadcasting is well known. At 5 a.m., while I was asleep in our apartment a few blocks away, riot police with truncheons raided the building, dragged out and arrested the occupying students. Chris Wallace was arrested and used his bail phone call to phone in a live report from jail. The Harvard faculty met in a closed session and lopsidedly voted no confidence in President Pusey's decision to call in the police. We listened to the supposedly secret debate at the radio station. Unintentionally, the faculty meeting was being held in a lecture room on campus where WHRB had a permanent microphone connection. As a professional courtesy, we invited Crimson reporters to the station to listen with us. Meanwhile, we broadcast the substance of the debate live, with according to sources instead of direct audio. It didn't take long for this subterfuge to be discovered. Instead of disconnecting our microphone, the faculty voted to allow us broadcast their meetings live. These Harvard professors could not resist the opportunity of orating to a larger audience. The local student stringer for the New York Times was a Crimson reporter named Carrie Grusin, the daughter of Flora Lewis, the famous New York Times foreign correspondent and columnist. I helped her upload audio tape by phone to the Times newsroom. From today's perspective, it is hard to appreciate the significance to Harvard of the events of April 1969. Student activism against the Vietnam War was, on other campuses, much more violent. Buildings were set on fire and people were killed. At Harvard, no one was killed, no one even seriously injured. Only a few of the arrested students were subsequently convicted of any crime. In the aftermath of the occupation, there was a student strike, largely but not completely, over the issue of amnesty for the arrested students with regard to their Harvard permanent records. Looking back, it seems pretty tame. Still, it is not an exaggeration to point to April 1969 as the tipping point between old Harvard and what subsequently became quite a different institution. Hard now to recall is how very different old Harvard was from the institution that it subsequently became. Paternalism, in old Harvard, was an unabashedly good thing. The university was literally and legally in loco parentis, acting in place of parents toward its students. That President Pusey could call in riot police to beat with truncheons in effect his own children was to the Harvard faculty of the time unforgivable. Chemist George Kistiakowsky and economist Alexander Gershenkron were passionate about this in speeches before the full faculty. But they missed the point. What the students were demanding was not a return to safe paternalism, but the end of it. Student activism in the late 1960s was an uprising by a very specific cohort, those older than 18 and less than 20-something, an ultimately successful campaign whose result was the recognition of this cohort as adult, not just legally, but also practically, in matters of university policies and national politics. The impetus for this revolution, first, for the political awareness that was its prerequisite, was the war in Vietnam, and specifically, the draft. Harvard had already changed superficially in my 4 years. No more coats and ties for dinner. No more parietal hours in dorms. Those changes old Harvard could easily absorb. What it could not easily accept was the idea that students should be empowered as adults to negotiate the conditions of Harvard student life, and even the educational curriculum itself, and negotiate by a fractious political, not neatly paternalistic process that at the time lacked even basic civility. This loss of civility was a mortal wound from which the old Harvard could not recover. Deans Ford and Watson resigned in 1970, President Pusey in 1971. All were disappointed men, old, white, WASP men, notably. Still, Harvard was a resilient institution. Some version of a new Harvard would replace the old. It had happened several times before in Harvard's 350 years. Livermore Lab required me to have a physical exam before starting employment. At University Health Services, the physician commented that my sophomore year hernia did not seem to him completely repaired. Really? I left with not just Livermore's form, but also a letter stating that I had a possible military disability. That week, Margaret and I set our wedding date, September 9th, in the Pasadena Jewish Temple, the same as where I had been bar mitzvahed. Our living arrangements for the summer were that we would live close to the campus in Berkeley, and I would reverse commute, drive in the uncrowded direction, the 40-minute drive to Livermore. A whirlwind of happenings was associated with the end of the semester and my graduation. I was taking Schwinger's course pass-fail this semester, and I barely passed. My other grades were good, and I graduated in Group 1 with high, but not highest, honors. At the congratulatory Phi Beta Kappa luncheon, I got to shake hands with Senator Eugene McCarthy, the guest of honor. McCarthy was a progressive senator from Minnesota and had challenged Lyndon Johnson, and then Johnson's anointed successor Hubert Humphrey, for the 1968 Democratic presidential nomination. His opposition to the Vietnam War won him universal favor among college students. I sat next to a Mr. Shattuck, class of 1901, and across from Judge Wysansky, class of 1927. Shattuck had served as Harvard's treasurer during the 1930s Great Depression. Wysansky was the liberal federal district judge who had recently made headlines by ruling expansively in favor of conscientious objectors to the war. Shattuck, it turned out, had been a minor judge in the Nuremberg trials. Wysansky: Mr. Shattuck, did you graduate from the college with distinction? Shattuck: I did not, sir, and did you? I am proud to say that I did not. However, let me repeat what Judge Learned Hand once said to me when I was clerking for him. And so on. Harvard's 1969 commencement did not follow the usual script. To head off student demonstrations, an SDS representative was allowed to give a rebuttal to the Harvard president's address. The chosen student was unfortunately so overripe in Maoist slogans that he was booed both by the reunion alumni for his politics and by the graduating students for his hackneyed tropes. President Pusey awarded degrees with the set formulas that, while not Maoist, were equally hackneyed. The script for the dentist was supposed to be, "You are now a part of that ancient and honorable calling that deals with oral disease," but his microphone cut out momentarily, so that only the phrase, "oral disease," echoed loudly in the arena between Memorial Church and Wedner Library. At the Kirkland House luncheon, I was technically still a house member, a drunken Master Smithies spoke to parents and students. "They say that coeducation will eventually come to the Harvard houses. Let me assure you, as long as I am master, there will be no women living in Kirkland House." He was right about that. A year later, Kirkland House was fully co-ed and Smithies was no longer master. When we drove to my parents' house in Belmont immediately after the ceremonies, a letter from my draft board was waiting for me. My deferment was ended. I was reclassified as 1A and would be called up for induction into the U.S. Army as soon as the board's monthly quota required it. Chapter 15. Livermore Caltech had an office specifically for helping students avoid being drafted. I contacted them before we left Cambridge. Now in Pasadena, I went to talk to Mrs. Toy. She had already called her Hertz Foundation counterpart, Mrs. Nyholm, and the two had arranged for Dr. Teller, as the father of the hydrogen bomb, to write a letter to my draft board. On the phone, Mrs. Nyholm read me the letter. "William Press's work at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory and the California Institute of Technology is more important to our nation's security than were Washington's boats on the Delaware River, than were Lincoln's railroads and telegraph lines in the Civil War, than were Patton's tanks in World War II. Those weren't exactly Teller's words, but his were fictions of a similar order. This was my first glimpse of the contradictory faces of Edward Teller. On the world stage, he truly did great harm. I never doubted this, then or now. The evidence was clear. He was a rabid and irrational anti-communist, a Dr. Strangelove. Indeed, the character in Stanley Kubrick's 1964 film is transparently based on Teller. Actor Peter Sellers' pseudo-German accent was not so different from Teller's Hungarian. Strangelove's wheelchair and artificial arm echoed Teller's limp and artificial leg, the result of a streetcar accident in his youth. Teller was a believer that his ends justified any means. The Oppenheimer security clearance case had demonstrated that Teller had no hesitation in destroying the reputation of someone who stood in his way. But in person, Teller was charming, brilliant, and engaged, if, with his thick accent, sometimes difficult to understand. And he was fiercely loyal to the younger people in his circle, who now included me. Livermore Lab's high-security fences, guards, guns, and gates were a new experience for me. The lab was built on a one-mile square, what had been a World War II naval air station. In the 1960s, it was still surrounded by Livermore Valley vineyards and pasture land. Chain-link fence and barbed wire defined its perimeter, but there were also many interior fences and manned gates. I was issued a red picture badge, that color meaning that my security clearance had not yet come through. When it did, I would get a green badge. The procedure at every gate, perimeter, or internal was to hand the guard your badge, relinquish control of it. He would look at it, at you, and then hand it back. I was limited to gates leading into red areas, only small parts of the lab. To get from some red zones to others, without crossing a green area, I could take one of the communal bicycles that were parked about, exit the outer gate, and bike a half a mile around the perimeter. Most summer students had already gotten their clearances. For them, there were daily classified lectures on how nuclear weapons worked. We unwashed, just sat in our offices. My office mate was a visiting professor from the University of Cincinnati, Lou Witten. He was a man of my father's age, a professor of physics who worked on general relativity theory. Lou jump-started my education in that field, which gave me a leg up when I later started working for Kip Thorne at Caltech. Later, Lou became more famous as the father of mathematical physicist Ed Witten, a pioneer of string theory who was in 1990 the first physicist to receive a Fields Medal, the highest honor in pure mathematics. More, later, on my encounters with Ed. Lou's clearance was held up because he was a lefty who in the 1940s had associated with communist-sponsored organizations. Mine was held up, I found this out only later, because Margaret and I were living in sin. Those the exact words in the confidential FBI field report. The diabolical-seeming Lowell Wood dropped by late afternoon on my first day. He deplored the fact that I wouldn't, for now, be able to work on the classified topic that he had in mind. He promised to leave a stack of books and computer manuals on my desk overnight, they were there the next morning, and to escort me sometime soon to meet Edward, as he called him. Most people said Dr. Teller. Early afternoon on a Wednesday, two men with brown beards appeared in my office. One's beard was large and bushy, the stereotype of the absent-minded professor in a 1930s movie. The other's pointed beard and mustache could only have belonged to Captain Nemo. Captain Nemo lifted a chair, turned it toward the blackboard, and sat. The professor went to the blackboard, turned to face us, and began, "Of course you start with the field equations." He wrote an equation. Captain Nemo broke in gently. "Perhaps we should tell him why we're here, Jim." "You mean Jim? He doesn't know." The professor, Jim Wilson, was surprised. Captain Nemo was Jim LeBlanc. These were the two Jims that Kip Thorne, in a phone call, had suggested that I try to work for. "Are you working for us?" they now asked. I told them maybe I was, but I wasn't sure. I'd have to ask Lowell or Edward. The Jims were intending to write a hydrodynamic simulation program, a hydrocode they called it, capable of calculations in the black hole Kerr metric. Wilson gave me a paper to study. They told me that they would come back the next Friday. No one used the word bomb at Livermore. Nuclear bombs were referred to as devices. A hydrocode was what was known in the outside world as a bomb code, a classified secret computer program capable of simulating the behavior of an imploding in its trigger phase and then exploding fission or fusion bomb. The first primitive bomb code was written by the great Princeton mathematician John von Neumann and ran on the ENIAC computer in the late 1940s. The requirements of bomb codes drove the development of many of the earliest electronic computers, with the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission as sometimes the only customer. In the mid-1960s, Teller and others on the inside realized that bomb codes, by then much more advanced than von Neumann's, could also simulate the implosion and then the fusion-powered explosion of astronomical supernovas. Astrophysicists used the term gravitational collapse to a white dwarf star or black hole instead of the bomb maker's implosion. Some of what was in secret computer codes had been declassified, enough to allow Livermore and Los Alamos scientists to publish papers on supernovas and gravitational collapse. Teller was a main force behind the declassification of bomb code technology, in part out of a genuine scientific interest in astrophysical problems, and in part so that he could recruit more young scientists into Livermore's orbit, including me. Through the 1970s and well into the 1980s, hands-on experience with hydrocodes for astrophysical applications could only effectively be acquired at one of the two nuclear weapons design laboratories, Livermore or Los Alamos. Universities didn't have faculty with the necessary experience to teach the field and lacked sufficiently powerful computers to do this kind of research. A whole generation of academic computational astrophysicists, and also some other fields of shockwave physics, learned their craft at the labs. Conversely, the new and more powerful bomb codes that powered the redesign of the U.S. BAT nuclear arsenal under President Reagan in the 1980s were in some prominent cases the work of astrophysics graduate students, some of them Hertz fellows, who after getting their PhDs were captured into full-time lab work. I initially escaped such capture, but was caught by the nuclear weapons establishment in a different way some 30 years later, as we will eventually see. On their next visit, the professor and Captain Nemo presented me with 5 pages of pencil notes, what Wilson had been trying to write on my blackboard, now neatly transcribed by LeBlanc. At the top of every page, it said, "Unclassified, but do not copy." There was still some uncertainty about exactly how far the declassification had gone, and there was also a backlash opposing Teller, urging the lab to claim as proprietary trade secret some things that were legally already declassified. The Wilson-LeBlanc notes were a revelation for me, a way of looking at the physics of matter and radiation that was different from anything I had learned as an undergraduate at Harvard. The physics itself wasn't new to me, but it was operationalized in a way that I had never seen before. It was the difference between tasting a cake, Harvard, and baking a cake, Livermore. The Wilson LeBlanc pencil notes were not a computer program. They were mathematical equations describing physics, but written in such a way as to make it obvious how to turn them into a computer simulation program. The lab allowed Wilson to present papers on his supernova calculations at open international meetings. After his talk, he would always be surrounded by a gaggle of Soviet attendees with questions. Someone later explained to me that when Soviet scientists returned from foreign travel, they underwent a required security debriefing by the KGB. The smallest snippet of information from Jim Wilson was a golden ticket to future foreign travel. Of course, Wilson never actually revealed anything that was classified. Subsequently, at Caltech, I never did actually write my own hydrocode, but I referred to my Do Not Copy Wilson LeBlanc notes many times for inspiration on how to operationalize different kinds of physics. My PhD thesis would be, in effect, one particular operationalization of Einstein's field equations of general relativity. Today, the idea of framing physics in a way that enables computer simulations is so taken for granted that it is hard to remember that this was a big paradigm shift. It was happening just when I entered graduate school. Edward Teller was 60 in 1969 and hadn't personally participated in scientific work of any kind, classified or not, in decades. Instead, he reigned on the ultra-conservative right as a political figure with enormous influence. He used that influence to benefit endeavors that interested him, or to which he was temperamentally loyal, varying from matters with national and global scope. President Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative in the 1980s, popularly known as Star Wars, to be discussed later, to anything affecting his Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, and to matters as small as the Hertz Foundation, or as tiny as shielding Hertz Fellowship recipients from the draft. Teller had met retired multimillionaire John Hertz in the late 1950s and had convinced Hertz to redirect his small philanthropic foundation from undergraduate scholarships in mechanical engineering. Hertz's fortune was from founding the Yellow Cab Company in 1907 and the eponymous car rental company in 1918, to much grander graduate fellowships in fields that, in Teller's view, supported the U.S. in the Cold War. Teller also suggested, and personally delivered, an astounding list of right-wing celebrities to serve on the Hertz Foundation board. In my time, they included FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover and Air Force General Curtis B. LeMay. LeMay's statement about North Vietnam that we should use nuclear weapons to bomb them back to the Stone Age led President Johnson to hasten LeMay's retirement from the Air Force in 1965. In 1968, LeMay was vice presidential candidate on George Wallace's third-party segregationist ticket. Although the Hertz Foundation had a nominal president, Floyd Odlum, a retired financier who had famously guaranteed the funds to develop the Atlas missile when the government was slow to come through, and an administrator, Mrs. Nyholm, all the real power lay with Lowell Wood. In this and many other matters, Wood functioned as Teller's vicar on Earth, remaining so for three decades until Teller's death in 2003. I was one of the earlier acolytes in the Teller Wood Church. At Livermore, Wood overcame bureaucratic impediments by invoking Teller's name, and Teller, if asked, reliably backed him. It was probably Lowell who had actually written the over-the-top letter to my draft board. Lowell was a genuine polymath, one of the most creative people I had ever met or would ever meet. At Livermore, already the summer I was there, he was leading a small group of young scientists working on things that had nothing to do with the lab's mission or sources of funding. The magic words were, "Dr. Teller wants this done." Wood's group, a kind of skunk works later formalized by the lab as O Group, did accomplish some things, but equally often, it promised miracles and delivered only ViewGraph presentations promising yet more miracles. Lowell's talent as a polymath often did not extend to actually getting a project successfully completed. But I am not being quite fair. Where O Group did succeed was in producing alumni and collaborators who went on to achieve great success, becoming distinguished professors, department heads, and deans, and founding significant companies. Computer pioneers John Hennessy, who was later president of Stanford, and John McCarthy, later to win the Turing Prize, were part of O Group collaborations, as was Nathan Myhrvold, a Hertz Fellow whose company was an early acquisition by Microsoft and who, much later, became known in some circles as the world's most hated patent troll. O Group members Kurt Widows and Tom McWilliams invented much of what became the whole industry of computer-aided electronic design. Tom Weaver became, in academia, the world authority on supernovas, and, for his secret nuclear weapons work, won the U.S. government's E.O. Lawrence Medal. My perspective on Lowell Wood is not unusual among those who knew him. He was touched with genius. He was an inspiration to our careers and a brilliant mentor. His scientific reliability was variable, and his ethics echoed those of his mentor, Dr. Teller. Wood, Teller, and O Group were later the subject of science writer Bill Broad's 1985 book, Star Warriors. Broad portrays his subjects in generally heroic terms, if occasionally misguided in their fondness for nuclear weapons. I reviewed the book for Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. Margaret's in my apartment that summer was a couple of blocks from People's Park, a plot of land owned by UC that had become a de facto place for counterculture people to hang out. A couple of weeks before we moved in, the university announced plans to build a dormitory on the land and put up construction fences. On what happened to be Bastille Day, the local populace, Berkeley students, stormed the local fortress, People's Park. Police responded in force, and skirmishes continued all day. Margaret and I went out onto Telegraph Ave to participate. Soon enough, someone threw a brick through a police car window, and a swarm of police descended and shot tear gas grenades. We decided to stay out on the street as long as there weren't gunshots. The tear gas, while quite unpleasant, left the protesters motivated enough to become even more violent, and the size of the crowd grew. We were mobile enough to avoid the gas for a time, but did finally get trapped in a big cloud. Eyes running and unable to breathe, we stumbled around the block, home. But 15 minutes later, we went out again and rejoined the now larger crowd. Harry Solon, who was my Hertz interviewer with Lowell Wood, spent a lot of time chatting with me in the Red Badge Ghetto. He seemed to have little else to do. Harry was interested in a peculiar set of unrelated things at the fringe of physics, and I was a well-paid, captive audience. We talked about information theory and some strange old ideas of de Broglie, recently resurrected by the Bayesian statistician Ed Janes, that bits and entropy should underlie quantum mechanics. Separately, Harry kept coming back to the idea of a holographic movie. Just like a hologram that could be viewed from all angles, this hypothetical movie could be viewed from all times, including seeing the future. Another of Harry's ideas was that, since even irreversible processes are, according to Ansager's laws, he said, very slightly reversible, it ought to be possible to hear what someone is dreaming by recording tiny motions of their eardrums. When I later summarized all this to Lowell, he told me that Harry had been an ordinary computational physicist until 2 years before, when he suddenly had gone off the deep end and began talking in this way. Lowell didn't tell me to stop spending time with Harry, however, so I continued to do so. It was like listening to Steve Hawley in Holton's lab. The work was easy and the pay was good. Margaret and I spent all day Sunday, July 20th, 1969, glued to the television, watching the coverage of the moon approach and landing. One of the instruments that the astronauts left on the moon was a long-period seismometer that my father had helped design. On Monday, Lowell visited my office with a man whom he introduced as Dr. John Knuckles. Knuckles was a small, thin man in his late 30s. His mouth was at all times perfectly horizontal, and he smiled by widening his lips rather than curving them upward. He was the laboratory's best bomb designer, the winner of the previous year's AEC Lawrence Prize for Weapons Development. Knuckles and Lowell had been arguing about the value of the United States keeping secret the basic concepts involved in designing a hydrogen bomb. Lowell thought that even an uncleared first-year summer student could design an adequate bomb. Knuckles said, "Put your money where your mouth is," and they came to visit me. This was something that I could actually work on that was not Harry's closet of horrors. Wood and Knuckles did what they absolutely weren't supposed to. They tracked down everything written about H-bomb design in the open literature and brought me copies. Worse, from a strict security perspective, They spent hours talking with me about the physics implied by the papers they brought. There is a legal concept, classification by compilation. That is where they were breaking the rules. No single paper on my desk was classified, but they, who knew the secrets of the H-bomb, were selectively choosing what to bring and discuss with me. By the end of the month, I had a sketch, backed by many pages of calculations, of what I thought was a viable H-bomb design. I was wrong about that, however. Knuckles won the bet. Later, when my clearance finally did come through, after Margaret and I were married and I was no longer living in sin, I made several trips from Caltech back to Livermore to be tutored by Knuckles on how things really worked. I had gotten a few tricks right, but missed many of the essential ones. 247. In the decades since, almost everything involved in fusion weapons design has appeared in the open literature. Today, with a selection of papers chosen with insider knowledge, Lowell would almost certainly win the bet. Luckily, there is also much more in the open literature that is wrong or misleading. The rules about classification by compilation are thus more relevant today than they were when Lowell and John were breaking them on my behalf. In my last week, Lowell and Harry escorted me inside the Green Badge Only fence to an appointed meeting with Teller, John Knuckles, and the current laboratory director, Michael May. May, born in 1925 in Marseille, France, emigrated to the United States as a teenager, but forever spoke with a pronounced French accent. He earned his BA at the age of 19 and a PhD in physics from Berkeley in 1952. He then immediately joined the new, secret Livermore lab. He liked to relate. The first guy I met said, "I suppose you know we're actually working on hydrogen bombs?" My jaw dropped. I was supposed to tell these three what I had accomplished in the course of the summer. All the other summer students had done this as a group. I was alone because by now I was the only student still without a security clearance. I decided to talk about three things. My hydrogen bomb, which Lowell assured me would interest Edward even if it was wrong. Some thinking about acausality, i.e., time travel, in the Kerr metric in general relativity that was inspired by my communist office mate, Lou Witten, and some of my own thinking about Schrödinger's cat in quantum mechanics, one of the less crazy things in Harry Solin's closet. In the famous thought experiment of Schrödinger, the cat is quantum mechanically both alive and dead at the same time. Whether you view this as a bug or a feature, tests whether you truly believe in quantum mechanics. As if it was an oral exam, Teller quizzed me closely on everything I said. When I got to Schrödinger's cat, his interruptions became more frequent and pointed. Finally, he said, "I am not certain that everything you say is wrong, but I am sure that it is all at least misleading. I should have been very much misled if I was exposed to this sort of thinking at your age." I looked at Harry and saw him shaking his head slowly from side to side. As I was leaving, Laboratory Director May said to me, "We are sorry that you were here this summer without clearance." Knuckles' version to me was, "I'm sorry we cannot have a free and frank discussion about your work." Later, Harry explained how I had stumbled onto the Schrödinger third rail. On precisely the subject of Schrödinger's cat, Teller had once had an idea of his own. He tried to explain it to Bohr on the train to Los Alamos during the war, but Bohr was dismissive. Only after Bohr was dead did Teller publish the idea, in German, in a collection of essays honoring Heisenberg. Harry located a translation of Teller's essay and, after I read it, arranged for me to have a second interview with Edward, which went much better. "You may be right," he concluded graciously. "I see the way you're trying to think about it," he added, slightly less graciously. Teller did like the idea that I would use my Hertz fellowship to study astrophysics. This was reassuring to me, given that the stated scope of the fellowship was for applied physical sciences in the national interest, and that I was relying on him to keep me out of Vietnam. Also, in my last week, Harry took it on himself, dropping Teller's name as necessary, to get to the bottom of my withheld clearance. He reached someone named Stinson in AEC security, who confirmed that my cohabitation was the sole issue. The result of this investigation by Harry was an agreement with the AEC that the day after my wedding to Margaret, I would send a telegram to Harry, who would inform Stinson at the AEC, who would release my clearance. It happened as agreed. The next time I visited Livermore, I was a newlywed with a brand new green badge. Chapter 16, Teller. Having described Edward Teller, Lowell Wood, and John Knuckles as I knew them in 1969, I want to jump forward in time almost 15 years to 1983. I was by then chair of the astronomy department at Harvard. On March 23, 1983, President Ronald Reagan declared that the United States was developing a space-based system of nuclear bomb-powered X-ray lasers to shoot down Soviet missiles, his strategic defense initiative, popularly known as Star Wars, after the movies. I knew more about the backstory of SDI than most. The original concept of an X-ray laser powered by the explosion of a small nuclear bomb was developed by Peter Hagelstein and Tom Weaver in Lowell Wood's O Group. And George Chaplin, a theoretical physicist at Livermore who had done his PhD at Caltech with Murray Gell-Mann, and who alternated between pure theoretical physics and bomb-related work. Lowell brought the unvetted and untested idea to Teller, and Teller took it directly to Reagan. I similarly knew more than was public about how that part happened. My father, as formerly President Jimmy Carter's science advisor, was in close communication with President Reagan's science advisor, Jay Keyworth. I mentioned to my father what my Livermore friends were saying, that Edward Teller had sold the president on a third generation of nuclear weapons, at that time the euphemism for the very secret X-ray laser. It was all a mistake, Frank said. The president had indeed asked to see Teller, but only ceremonially. Keyworth was told to arrange it, but he dragged his feet because he knew that Edward couldn't be trusted to stick to any agenda. The meeting could be approved only as an innocuous philosophical discussion on arms control. Finally, after reassurance from Teller, it was put on the president's calendar. Edward strode into the Oval Office and, before he could be stopped, laid out for the president the whole crazy Star Wars plan. Outside, in the hall, Reagan's senior aides, including Ed Meese, were angrily shaking their fists at Jay. Inside, the president told Edward that it all sounded fine and that he would commit to go ahead with it. He may have thought that Teller's proposals had been filtered through advanced scrutiny and only brought to him, as most things were, for a ceremonial final nod. The very first actual test of the X-ray laser concept with the necessary nuclear bomb occurred underground in Nevada only well after Reagan's announcement of SDI. Its results were held in a new security compartment, Sigma 12, that was inaccessible even to people with top-secret Q clearances, who now included me. It took several years for it to leak out that the reason for all this security was not that the idea worked, but that it didn't work. This and other foundational technologies of SDI were fantasies, at best impossibly optimistic, at worst fraudulent, entirely consistent, in other words, with the miracles that Wood's O Group had previously, not actually, produced. Already underway before Teller's performance in the Oval Office was a massive upgrading of the U.S. nuclear arsenal, with both new weapons designs and greater numbers. That effort was where most of Livermore Laboratory's effort was, the most money and the most jobs, including the talents of its best weapons designers, of whom John Knuckles was one. Livermore and Los Alamos, although government labs, functioned as billion-dollar-scale corporate pieces of U.S. defense industry. That Teller had hoodwinked the U.S. president into what most of establishment Livermore thought was a scientifically unsound wild goose chase was not universally appreciated. Former Los Alamos lab director Harold Agnew later told me another Star Wars story. He was one of the small audience in the White House when Reagan delivered the nationally televised SDI speech. The substance of the speech, roughly a new fortress America, was clearly at odds with the U.S. treaty obligation under NATO to defend Europe equally. Agnew was sitting between Secretary of State George Shultz and former Secretary of State William Rogers. During the speech, Rogers leaned over and whispered to Shultz, "Were our allies consulted on this?" The incumbent Shultz whispered back, "I have no idea." This is all background to a phone call I got in July 1983 from Mike May. Although no longer laboratory director, as he was when I was introduced to him as a summer student, Mike was still a power at the lab. There was a vacancy in the position of associate laboratory director for physics. Teller, re-energized by SDI at now age 75, was promoting Lowell Wood for the job. May and the establishment leadership favored my other former mentor, the more measured and sensible John Knuckles. Roger Batzel, the current laboratory director, was expected to retire soon, and whoever became the new associate director would be the heir apparent. May and others were terrified at the prospect of Lowell's ever becoming laboratory director. Their proposed scheme was devious enough to be interesting. I would apply for the associate director job. Although I had long since flown from the teller nest, May and the establishment could still represent me as a second teller candidate, an outsider choice to compete with Lowell as the insider one. As a Harvard professor and department chair and former Hertz fellow, I had already achieved enough success to be cited as a model of Teller's and Wood's mentorship, so it would be hard for Edward to disown me completely. Then, Knuckles would emerge as the compromise candidate and get the job. I agreed to the plan and in late July traveled to Livermore for a day of interviews that went very well because most of the search committee was in on the plot. I had a scheduled meeting with Lowell, nominally because I had been his student. He kept me waiting half an hour, breezed in with the comment, "Et tu, Brute?" and quickly left. He may have spent a part of the prior half hour alerting Teller, who now lived across the bay next to Stanford's Hoover Institution. Word came of a sudden change in my schedule. A car would take me to have dinner at home with Dr. Teller and his wife Mitzi, pronounced Mitzi. At his home, Edward greeted me effusively, put me in a chair in his living room, and told me about his theory of gamma ray bursts, then, as later, a problem of interest in astrophysics. He was quick and creative, even in his 70s. In passing, he made reference to some papers of mine to show me that he had read my CV. We went into dinner. "We must not speak physics at dinner," Edward said. "The lady, his wife, is not only not a physicist, but is also Hungarian." This was a Teller joke, since Michi's Hungarian accent was as close to incomprehensible as Edward's. Edward always spoke slowly, as if he was thinking every word in Hungarian, then translating it into German, and only finally into English. At dinner, just three of us at the table served by a Mexican maid, we talked politics. More precisely, what transpired was this. Edward raised one or another of his favorite subjects: importance of ballistic missile defense, futility of negotiated agreements with Russians, the Soviet threat to the US, general untrustworthiness of Russians, categorical evil of Russians, general deficiencies of communism, etc. On each subject, with great tact and charm, he would draw me out regarding my own views. After I provided some witty and quotable statements revealing of my academic, socialist, communist, Democratic Party attitudes, in any case enough for him to later use to discredit me as needed, we went on smoothly to the next topic. It was a lot of fun. It was a dream opportunity. Here was Edward Teller, hanging on my every word and asking me about my political views. I could be the one who succeeded in turning him into a liberal if I could just find just the right compelling and logical arguments. "You're absolutely right, Bill," he might then say. "I've been completely wrong for the last 40 years. I now see the error of my ways. I'm going to announce tomorrow that I support the nuclear freeze movement, and I'm going to start campaigning for Teddy Kennedy." We moved to the living room for the final act of the drama, or farce. Edward raised the subject of Lowell explicitly for the first time. "Lowell was a genius many times over," he told me. "Lowell's invention of the key concept in the X-ray laser was the equal of his own invention of the key concept in the fusion bomb. Lowell's invention would make total nuclear defense possible." "And we need you at the laboratory," he said vehemently and unexpectedly. "We need someone with your ability and accomplishment and your scientific talent. I want to make you a much better offer than this associate director position," which he dismissed with a wave of his eyebrows. "Of course, I will have to call the director to make this offer official, but you can count on it. Come to the laboratory to do anything you want. Work in any division, on any subject that interests you, except administration or policy matters, of course, for as long as you like, fully supported with a high salary for the rest of your life." I thanked him and said I would think about it. Teller walked me to my waiting car and again thanked me for coming to see him. "Take very good care of him," he said to the driver. I watched out the rear window to be sure that he was not putting a stick of dynamite up the tailpipe. Mike May's plan succeeded perfectly. Knuckles got the associate director job and then succeeded Roger Batzel as laboratory director in 1988. Lowell was never promoted to any position of higher leadership at the lab. Since the 1991 collapse of the USSR, historians have debated, will forever debate, the role, if any, that Reagan's SDI played in the Soviet demise. In nuclear weapons circles, the self-congratulatory belief is that, regardless of whether SDI was achievable or was fantasy, the U.S. seeming willingness to invest in its astronomical cost was a factor in convincing Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev that the Cold War was unwinnable and that the USSR must move toward perestroika and glasnost, restructuring and openness, inevitably leading to the revolutions in Eastern Europe, the rise of Boris Yeltsin, and the dissolution of the USSR. Most academic historians dispute this version of events. However, in later years, Gorbachev did write that his nuclear advisors told him with certainty that SDI was based on faulty physics and could never succeed, but that, regardless, the Soviet Union would have to start a matching program so as to avoid the appearance of surrendering to the American yoke. But let us now return to 1969. The beginning of September saw my remarkable transformation. From Berkeley radical student sympathizer, living in sin with my girlfriend, gassed by the police at People's Park, and paradoxically, designing non-working hydrogen bombs at Livermore Laboratory, I became over the course of 2 weeks a happily married, hard-working Caltech graduate student in physics, living in a compact little house on South Parkwood Avenue that boasted wall-to-wall carpets, a washer, dryer, dishwasher, unusual, and central air conditioning, very unusual in Pasadena. Margaret had found our rental house on a trip south to see her parents. Our landlord, Mr. Lindemann, a retired small business owner, lived with his wife in the equally modest house just behind ours on the same lot. Rent was $200 per month. The neighborhood was white, lower middle class, Republican. Mr. Lindemann had quizzed Margaret to be sure that we would fit in. She passed the test, that we would both be working on PhDs and not in suspect fields like English or social science, was in our favor. 2:53, our wedding reception was held in the Lauritsen's backyard, beautifully decorated for the occasion. Tommy had strung colored lights over the caterer's tables and starched tablecloths. Margaret and I departed at an appropriate time for our fictional honeymoon, to cheers and toasts, riding on her Honda 90 motorcycle, she in back with her arms around me and still in her wedding dress, me in my rented tuxedo. Caltech was a kind of West Point of physics graduate schools. They didn't call us plebes, but they might as well have. The week before classes, we had a day with 90-minute placement exams in each of four basic subjects: mechanics, electromagnetism, quantum mechanics, and the catch-all of modern physics. If you passed, you were qualified to take graduate courses in those same areas. If you failed, you took Caltech's undergraduate courses instead, generally delaying your PhD by a year. These were not easy exams. In electromagnetism, my score was 2 points out of 50, and I passed. People with scores of 1 or 0 failed. There were several such. The required first-year graduate courses were much harder than any physics course I had at Harvard. I often spent 8 hours or more on a single course's single week's problem set. Candidacy exams were given in the spring. If you passed, you were allowed to be accepted for thesis research by a professor. Otherwise, you retook courses and tried again a year later. If you failed a second time, you left. I missed registration day, which came a few days after the placement exams, because my draft board ordered me to report to the nearest induction center for a pre-induction physical exam. I telephoned their office in Cambridge to understand how this came about. Had they not received a letter from none other than Edward Teller? The helpful woman on the other end of the line found my file. "The letter is here," she told me, "but the meeting notes say that the board has never heard of this Edward Teller." I thus reported to the induction center at 1023 S Broadway in Los Angeles at 7:30 a.m. on Monday, September 29, 1970. At 7:50, they started us through. We filled out myriad senseless forms, then started following a red line on the floor from examining station to examining station. The work was mostly done by enlisted medics whose medical skills were rudimentary, especially in trying to find a vein to draw blood. We marched through stations number 1 through number 14 in shoes and underpants. The examination was undisguisedly Potemkin. At station number 15, we lost our underpants and met our first real doctor, who came down the line and checked each person in a couple of seconds: eyes, ears, abdomen, and rectum. Checking my abdomen for hernias and finding none, my doctor was about to proceed to my rectum. I said loudly, "Doctor, I have 2 hernias." He stopped long enough for me to show my physician's letter, gave me a more thorough second examination, taking 4 seconds, and wrote "Hern Bill LYR" on my folder. An hour later, I arrived at the final station, the summarizing physician. "You fail," he said. "Hernias, 1-year deferment." He didn't return my smile. All of the physics faculty knew exactly who I was, Tommy Lauritsen's new son-in-law. There was no use in my pretending otherwise. Caltech was a small place, and my father, Frank, had been gone only 4 years, so most also knew that I was his son. It did not take long for me to get a reputation as a troublemaker. By long tradition, all exams at Caltech were unproctored take-home exams. However, I refused to sign Caltech's honor code pledge. Ward Whaling, the physics graduate advisor, shrugged and sent me to graduate dean Frederick Bonenblust, to whom I rendered a one-sided, practically Talmudic, some would say Jesuitical, monologue on the ethics of snitching on others, that the only part of the code that I objected to. "I don't have a problem with any of that," he said, yawning. "I'm sure you'll do the right thing." Bonenblust was later briefly succeeded as acting graduate dean by Max Delbruck, a Nobel Prize winner and one of the great biologists of the 20th century. I had several friendly run-ins with him, too. Decades later, when I became a biologist, I bragged to colleagues, almost truthfully, that Delbruck knew me well as a graduate student. Harvard had rules, and it had procedures for dealing with students who broke the rules. Harvard's tempering grace came at the end of the process, when, except for the single case of President Pusey's calling in the police to University Hall, a paternalistic mercy would prevail. Caltech also had rules, but no procedures. Its approach to troublesome students was to try to talk them off the ledge, or, failing that, to ignore them. A sole exception was the Honor Code Court, which was run by fanatical undergraduates without faculty supervision, this also by long tradition, and which had the power to have students, including graduate students, expelled from Caltech. No sensible physics faculty member ever referred cases involving graduate students to this court, but visiting or new professors sometimes made the mistake of doing so, with consequences always disastrous and disproportionate to the offense for the poor, almost always foreign. Student. In my final year of graduate school, the physics department couldn't come up with anyone to be its graduate representative on the court, so I ran unopposed on the announced platform, "I will vote to acquit all students brought before the court, regardless of the facts." I was on the jury in just a couple of cases. The facts, such as they were, left me feeling good about honoring my campaign pledge. In hindsight, I was lucky that my field was physics. The prevailing culture in physics, then and now, was personal and professional arrogance. Caltech, again resembling West Point, saw itself as training for the profession in attitude as well as in competency. The physics faculty likely saw my arrogance as a role model for the other students. I would never have made it in biology, a kinder and gentler field. I made an appointment to see Kip Thorne soon after the start of the semester and asked him if I could work for him. He said that if I needed an official thesis advisor to get out of the draft, he would take me on as a first-year student, otherwise not. I told him that I had a temporary deferral that would last at least a year. In that case, he said, I could attend his weekly group meetings informally, and I might similarly come to seminars and hang around with his graduate students in the Relativity Interaction Room, a kind of a lounge and informal library that was next to his office. Kip was the youngest full professor at Caltech, then not even 30. He had been Professor John Wheeler's star PhD student at Princeton, come to Caltech as an associate professor straight out of graduate school, and been promoted to full professor just 2 years later. Actually, Kip was only Wheeler's second best student. Richard Feynman, Nobel laureate and proud fixture on the Caltech faculty, had been Wheeler's best 25 years earlier. Feynman was instrumental in getting the untested Kip appointed at Caltech as successor in a faculty line that went back to Einstein, who had been a regular Caltech visitor in the 1920s. As a fan of Pasadena's sunny Southern California climate and then resort atmosphere. When Einstein's visits ceased, Richard Chase Tolman became the relativity professor in the 1930s and 1940s, then H.P. Robertson in the 1950s and until his retirement. Kip was next in that line. Most professors weren't allocated space for an interaction room for their students, but Kip was a star. A whole series of Kip's weekly group meetings were devoted to discussion, chapter by chapter, of a mimeographed translation of the recent Russian monograph, Relativistic Astrophysics, by Yabi Zeldovich and Igor Novikov. Zeldovich, then in his middle 50s, was famous in the West as the father of the Soviet atomic bomb. He had, according to Kip, put aside his classified bomb work to devote himself purely to unclassified astrophysics. Zeldovich's protege and younger friend Andrei Sakharov was correspondingly known as the father of the Soviet hydrogen bomb, the Russian Edward Teller. Sakharov was just becoming known as a Soviet dissident at this time. Zeldovich, then and later, remained publicly apolitical. His prestige as a Soviet hero enabled him to run his academic group in Moscow unburdened by interference from the KGB, unlike most Soviet scientific groups. Kip had somehow become a regular visitor to Zeldovich's group in Moscow, that very unusual in those Cold War times. He had found an American publisher who would pay for Relativistic Astrophysics to be translated into English, provided that Kip would edit the manuscript for scientific accuracy. When the translator turned out to know little physics, this proved to be a major task. That Kip knew some Russian, not much more than I did, helped only slightly. These weekly discussions were chapter-by-chapter tests of whether the edited translation was comprehensible to graduate students. I didn't always understand the physics, but, ever the troublemaker, I complained loudly about the quality of the English prose. The result was that Kip started routing his red ink chapters to me for copy editing before they were retyped and mimeographed for the group. This became part of my routine, the way grading had been at Harvard. It was mostly things like changing the literal Russian writer of humoristic stories to the better Russian humorist. Kip was actually quite a good writer, but he had figured out that he could save time by leaving the routine stylistic editing to me, the ambitious and arrogant first-year student. The word nerd was not in common use at Caltech at this time, but it certainly described Kip. Born and raised in Logan, Utah, Kip's Mormon-born parents were both professors at Utah State, the state's land-grant college. When Kip came to Caltech as an undergraduate, then went to Princeton for graduate school, it was like shaking the soda bottle before letting it fizz. Nerd meets counterculture. In the late 1960s, he was a red-bearded faux hippie, most often dressed in an African dashiki that he had picked up, I think, in Moscow, where many Africans studied during the Cold War at Patrice Lumumba University. Kip and his beautiful red-haired wife Linda, his high school sweetheart, liked to host hard rock dancing parties at their sprawling old house in Altadena. Harry Salen called me to say that my clearance had finally come through. A few days later, I had a call from Lowell Wood. The Livermore Red Tape Department had come up with two rules. Travel expenses could not be paid for non-employees, and part-time employees could not be hired at less than 20% time. Lowell proposed to hire me at 20% time with the understanding that I would bank my salary and use it for travel to visit the lab. What would I actually do 8 hours a week? I'm sure that anything you are working on at Caltech is of interest to the lab. Didn't this arrangement violate the terms of my Hertz fellowship? Edward approves, as long as we don't put anything in writing. I visited the lab for a few days at a time, about once a month. I would drop in unannounced on members of the Teller Circle, Lowell, Harry, Wilson and LeBlanc, John Knuckles, George Chaplin, and the younger O Group people, and shamelessly ask them to unlock their safes for me to browse. These safes, so-called, were a kind of armored filing cabinets that stored secret and top-secret documents. My requests were completely against the rules, because I had no work-related need to know, especially not for every document they might happen to have. Nevertheless, most happily complied. Knuckles, who, once I was cleared, was always happy to tutor me in the black arts of nuclear weapons, did one-time object on principle. Lowell was there. Knuckles told Lowell that he didn't think that a mere former, part-time summer student, me, should be pawing through classified private correspondence between Teller and the Atomic Energy Commission. "I don't see why not," Lowell said argumentatively. The two of them went off to consult Edward, leaving me in Knuckles' office with the locked cabinet. When Knuckles returned, alone, he, without further comment, unlocked the repository and left the office. The necessity of maintaining my Livermore connection diminished significantly on December 1, 1969, when the first draft lottery took place. Instead of calling up inductees in an order of their own choosing, draft boards were required to use the order of the lottery results. My birthday, May 23rd, drew number 319 out of 366, leap day included. My draft worries were over. Others were not so lucky. Mentioning George Chaplin, and having mentioned in so different a context Zeldovich, I am reminded that these two actually had an unlikely relationship. This was years later, when the Cold War was starting to melt. I had by then met Zeldovich myself a couple of times, once in Warsaw and then in Moscow, to be related later. Chaplin, still at Livermore, was by then working mostly on astrophysics, and he was in Moscow for an international conference. Zeldovich caused an intermediary to make contact with George and make arrangements for the two of them to meet privately. In the USSR, this usually meant outdoors and in motion. Walks in the woods were not just metaphorical. It was clear that each knew a lot about the other's weapons work via classified intelligence sources on their respective sides. Chaplin returned from Moscow full of scientific and anecdotal information about the development of Soviet nuclear weapons. It was old, historical stuff, nothing that would then be useful to the United States in any competitive way. But it was surely still technically classified, both in the US and certainly the USSR. Chaplin was willing to talk about the scientific particulars only behind the fence at Livermore. The most likely interpretation was that Zeldovich wanted intellectual credit, including in the West, including behind our fences, for his nuclear weapons discoveries. He was a loyal Soviet, a hero, but apparently he trusted Chaplin to share his information only with members of this one peculiar world brotherhood, nuclear weapons designers on the two sides of the Iron Curtain. Zeldovich may also have wanted to take Sakharov's reputation down a notch. The latter had by then been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize and was a hero in the West. Zeldovich told Chaplin that he, Zeldovich, ran the whole hydrogen bomb effort, a reality not appreciated in the West. Sakharov, a young student, played a very limited role, he said. Zeldovich did credit him with suggesting what in the West was referred to as the Teller-Ulam trick. Lev Landau's role, in charge of the computational effort, was, Zeldovich said, much more significant. In the West, Landau is generally credited as the greatest Soviet theoretical physicist, famous for his celebrated School of Theoretical Physics in Kharkov, later Kharkiv, and then Moscow, and for a series of graduate textbooks on all areas of theoretical physics, written in collaboration with his student Evgeny Lifshitz, that are still in use today. Lifshitz did most of the actual writing, leading to the physicist's joke, "Not a word of Landau and not a thought of Lifshitz." I met Lifshitz a couple of times before his death in 1985. When the Soviet device worked and prizes were handed out, Zeldovich won his third Hero of Socialist Labor Medal. The first two had been for the Tower fission device and for the airplane carryable version. Landau refused a medal, saying that he wanted only money instead. Nothing happened for a long time. Then one day there appeared a huge pile of rubles on his desk. He called all his staff in, said to them, "Take what you want," and left the room. They left all of it for him. He needed the money for his principal vice, womanizing. Once, in telling off a student, Landau said to him, "You are so lazy that you only have sex with your wife." 262. When I later came to know many of Zeldovich's students, they taught me the riddle: what is the difference between Landau and Zeldovich? The answer? Landau was a great physicist, but thought he was a great lover. Zeldovich is a great lover, but he thinks, they used an earthier Russian word than lover. Chapter 17. Gravitational waves. In addition to spending many hours on coursework, going to Kip's group meetings, and copy-editing his manuscript, I was writing a not very good science fiction novel, a project that only died a slow death. There was an undergraduate Caltech club that invited famous sci-fi authors to campus. I went to talks by Robert Heinlein, Arthur C. Clarke, Robert Silverberg, Poole Anderson, Jerry Pournelle, and Larry Niven, all of whose works I had read in their entireties. Heinlein came across as stiff and out of touch, which by then he was. Rumors already abounded that Heinlein's later books were being pieced together from incomplete partial manuscripts by his wife Ginny. Poole Anderson was a good friend of my father's Russian colleague Volodya Kalis Borok, so I introduced myself to him and we chatted. On one panel, Pournelle and Niven kept trying to get Sir Fred Hoyle, who was in the audience, to come to the front and join their panel, but he refused. I was sitting next to Fred and Caltech professor Willie Fowler because I had brought them to the talk. 2-7, in the 1950s, Fred, Willie, and the Burbages, a married couple, had first worked out the detailed theory of how the chemical elements are made by nuclear processes in stars. Hoyle's later works were a mixture of good and bad science. He was a proponent of the steady-state theory of cosmology, long after the Big Bang theory was extensively confirmed by the evidence. Willie was awarded a Nobel Prize in 1983, by which time Fred was in disrepute, but he wrote several science fiction novels, all of which I enjoyed. Willie and Fred will both make continuing appearances in my story. Clark was, we now know, prescient. He told us that major changes in life would stem from an exponential spreading of an information grid, he called it, to be made possible by communication satellites and computers. He compared this development to the revolutions brought by the piped water grid, the electric grid, the telephone grid, and so forth. But he said this next grid was going to be the big one. He was prognosticating 20 years before cell phones, the internet, the first web browsers, and AI. Except for the physical medium being mostly optical fibers instead of satellites, his vision was spot on. Statistics suggested that I would pass my candidacy exams, most people did, but there were moments of doubt. My cohort of classmates were all closed-mouthed about their weekly problem set scores and first semester grades, so I had almost no comparative data. On an absolute scale, my scores were abysmal. I rarely got more than half of the assigned problems correct. But, relatively, was that good or bad? I had no way to know. I did know that my classmates were spending more time studying than I was. A high school friend who still lived in Pasadena was going to shoot a self-produced movie in the Caltech steam tunnels with a plot about undergraduates who steal moon rocks brought back by the Apollo astronauts. I wrote the screenplay. Nothing ever came of this. The candidacy exams were all day on two consecutive Saturdays in April. A week before the first exam, Tommy, Margaret's father, was diagnosed with colon cancer. His major colostomy surgery took place 2 weeks after my second exam day. But even after that long second Saturday of exams, I had no idea how I had done. After more than a week of anxious days, I called Kip at home late one evening. He was audibly annoyed. "Oh, you passed with distinction. That's the top 25%. What did you expect?" The next day, I went to see Leverett Davis, the professor in charge of the exams. I felt pretty cocky. Now knowing that I had done well, I demanded greater transparency for future students, both before and after the exams. Davis listened noncommittally, eventually telling me that my score was number 2 in the class. "Actually, in effect, number 1, he added diffidently, "because a foreign Chinese student always gets the top score, and we discount that." I still went to classes, but those grades were now irrelevant. At the blackboard, Professor Fred Zachariasen muttered on. I took notes in class, if at all, like this. "In a plasma, there are 11 kinds of waves. In a wave, there are 11 kinds of modes. In a mode, there are 11 kinds of instabilities. Every instability is named after 11 physicists. Many are the names of God." Kip summoned to his office the 6 first-year students who wanted to work with him. Me, John Melvin, Jay Melosh, Richard Green, a Chinese student named Chen, not the one who beat me in the exam, and a silent bearded fellow whom none of us had ever seen before in classes. He would only take 2 of us, Kip said. Well organized as always, he had made a list of 6 small-bore research topics. We should each take 1 and work alone on it over the summer. Reviewing what we each accomplished, he would pick two winners. There was only one topic that interested me. It had to do with gravitational waves, a theoretical prediction of Einstein's theory of general relativity. None of the others wanted that topic, so it was mine. Why were gravitational waves on Kip's list of projects? In the 50 years since a young Einstein had pointed out their theoretical existence, no one had come up with any process, terrestrial or astronomical, that could produce these waves strongly enough to be detectable. Some relativists doubted their existence at all. The waves might merely be a subtle ambiguity inherent in the four coordinates of spacetime. In that case, a cleverer mathematician might cause them to disappear completely. But in 1969, about when I was graduating from Harvard, physicist Joseph Weber at the University of Maryland published a paper claiming to have detected gravitational waves of astronomical origin. Weber suspended a 3-ton cylindrical bar of aluminum in a shielded vacuum chamber and observed tiny bell-ringing events, as if the bar was being struck with the tiniest imaginable hammer at irregular intervals, about 3 times a day. Weber described how he had eliminated every possible explanation except Einstein's gravitational waves, which, like gravity, could penetrate anywhere, even to the inside of a shielded, isolated vacuum chamber. The problem was that Joe's waves were far too strong. You could collide known types of stars or collapse them in supernovas. The waves produced would be far too weak. You could collide so-called neutron stars, which had been predicted in the 1930s and finally observed as pulsars just 3 years earlier in 1967. Still far too weak. You could even collide black holes, at this time purely theoretical constructs that only relativists like Kip believed in. And even that was not enough. Weber's waves were 1,000,000 times more powerful than any yet conceived of source. Kip alternated between believing Weber's results, in which case he wanted, or wanted a student of his, to come up with the brilliant idea about what was producing them, and disbelieving Weber, in which case he or his student should propose where Weber was going wrong, and should help design a new experiment that would not have that fault. Professor Tommy Tombrello was interested in mounting such an experiment. I spent a lot of time over the summer talking to him and to Jim Mercereau, another professor in experimental physics. I studied the theory of measuring small signals. Vladimir Braginsky, a Soviet experimenter also interested in gravitational waves, was visiting Kip's group over the summer, and I learned a lot from him. Braginsky's English was very good, but there were words that he didn't know. Two pieces of his apparatus were separated by a piece of very thin, perfect non-conducting membrane, he paused, not knowing the right word. You can buy cheap at drugstore. For sex. A condom. Russian science was often like that, finding simple solutions that would elude the more sophisticated Western experimentalist. As the end of summer approached, I wrote up my results on gravitational waves, mostly incomplete ideas, incompletely worked out, for Kip and Tombrello. I had not been up to Livermore for a while, so I scheduled a visit with Lowell and company. Since my previous trip, the lab had changed my status from part-time employee to student visitor. The employment office had sent me all manner of paperwork on this, which Lowell told me to just ignore. One letter was about exchanging my green badge, technically now canceled, for a different one labeled student visitor. I decided to test the system by arriving right at the morning rush, when hundreds of people were streaming through the gate. The guard had a rhythm. Take a badge, look at it, hand it back, take the next person's badge, look at it, hand it back, and so on. In perfect rhythm, I handed him my badge, which looked exactly like all the others. He took it, looked at it, but didn't hand it back. "Mr. Press," he said with a crocodile smile, "come with me." It turned out that they had a most wanted list, and I was on it. In the security booth, he showed me the full-page notice with my large, smiling picture and the words, "Deny access, confiscate badge, direct to badge office." As punishment, he made me walk to the badge office 1 mile around the outside fence. I had to spend the morning filling out forms and promising to behave. Purely maliciously, they tried to make me watch all the security training films again. There was just one worth seeing, The Town Without Children, about a supposed Soviet training school for deep penetration agents that was the exact replica of an ordinary American town. But punchline, a town without children. I liked the meta-ness of it. American stock actors melodramatically overacting as Russian agents who were themselves acting, spectacularly well, we were to believe, as ordinary Americans, perhaps even employed as actors. Inside the fence, I wandered into John Knuckles' office and found George Zimmerman also there. George had been a Hertz fellow in my Caltech cohort until his draft board began closing in. Lowell then hired him at Livermore full-time. A letter from Edward, in his case, though not mine, produced a deferment. Since the cafeteria was outside the fence, after lunch I needed to go back in through a different security gate. The new guard took my new badge and didn't hand it back. "William Press," he said. The other guard said, "No, they canceled him this afternoon." "Thank you, sir," the first guard said to me, handing my new badge back. Chapter 18. Kip. In early September 1970, Margie Lauritsen was insistent that Margaret and I go on a 10-day vacation with Tommy and herself before our classes started. I felt that I had better things to do than travel with my in-laws. I had joined the American Booksellers Association and was in process of being certified as a legitimate retail bookstore. This involved having phony letterhead and business cards printed, and then lying on a bunch of forms. The payoff was that once certified, I would be able to order books from publishers as single copies for 40% off the retail prices. At this time, publishing was one of several consumer-facing industries with fixed retail prices. Publishers set the price of books, and it was illegal in most states for a retailer to sell to the public for any less. The retailers were, of course, willing co-conspirators, since the mandated markups were high. These so-called fair trade laws were enacted in the 1930s to help small businesses weather the Great Depression. Fair trade laws were finally nullified by an act of Congress in 1975. What I wanted to do before classes started was to spend my Hertz Fellowship book allowance. I particularly coveted the 10-volume Grove's Dictionary of Music and Musicians, 5th edition, which I had relied on at WHRB. Hertz gave me $500, especially for books, a huge amount then, and they didn't care what books I bought. Margie's insistence was low-key but unrelenting. A difficult life and husband had taught her how to get her way by persistence. Margaret and I considered it a victory that we were able to change the proposed destination to Hawaii instead of Jackson Hole. In hindsight, it is obvious that Margie's intransigence was because of Tommy's cancer prognosis. There might not be many such future opportunities. We were oblivious to this. Tommy's condition was never openly discussed. We did have a good time in Hawaii. The beaches were full of enlisted military on R&R from Vietnam, met in Hawaii by their wives or girlfriends. Often met with flowers, I quipped, because they are badly in need of a good lay. Tommy and I turned out to share a liking for off-highway driving. In our tiny rental car, we circumnavigated the Big Island on mostly dirt roads before making our way to Volcanoes National Park. Less accessible then than now, Volcano House was a kind of rugged resort hotel where one spent several days, took all meals in the dining room, and got to know one's fellow travelers. A kind of landlocked volcanic cruise ship. Tommy and Margie both liked this, and they extended our stay there by several days. It may also have been that Tommy was not up to the rigors of daily travel. When I registered for classes, several professors asked me how the trip had gone. Leverett Davis added, "Are you going to tell us how to run the department again this year?" His idea of a cute joke. Margaret and I led a dual existence. We were nominally struggling graduate students, supported by our fellowships at UCLA and Caltech, and at the same time, we were that cute young married couple, Tommy Lauritsen's and Frank Press kids, in demand socially in the hermetic Caltech community, especially the physics department and the Kellogg Lab, which had been founded by Margaret's grandfather, Charles Lauritsen. Kellogg Lab was famous for its parties, and the parties were famous for their heavy drinking. Willie Fowler and Tommy Lauritsen were drunken mainstays. Their after-hours alcoholism differed mainly in that Willie was a sweet and jolly drunk while Tommy tended to become abusive. These two had been friends since their Caltech undergraduate days. Both had done their PhDs under Charlie Lauritsen. Both were Caltech lifers. Willie was by now world famous. Tommy had never fully emerged from his father's shadow. Charlie Lauritsen had died just 3 years earlier, in 1968. One large dinner party at Margaret's parents' house was in honor of Augie Bohr, the physicist's son of Niels Bohr and then director of the Bohr Institute in Copenhagen. Augie and Tommy, contemporaries, had been friends since their pre-war postdoctoral days in Copenhagen. Augie Bohr did emerge from his famous father's shadow sufficiently to win the 1975 Nobel Prize in Physics for his work with Ben Mottelson on the structure of atomic nuclei. Augie had come to Pasadena now to deliver the inaugural Charles C. Lauritsen Memorial Lecture. This was a close-knit community. Margaret and I went to the party as much for the free meal as for anything else. The occasion brought out the extended Kellogg crowd, from Willie and Artie, Carl Anderson, and Dick Feynman, down through Stuart Harrison, Alvin Tolestrup and his post-divorce girlfriend, the Barneses, the Wasserbergs, Ward Whaling, Leverett Davis, Tommy Tumbrello, Kip and his wife, and us. Artie Fowler was Willie's long-suffering wife. What specifically she was long-suffering about had happened so far in the past that Margaret and I had no idea what it was. Carl Anderson had received the 1936 Nobel Prize in Physics for his discovery of the positron, the first known antimatter. Stuart Harrison was the Lauritsen family physician. A footnote in history was that Stuart's first wife, Kitty, met J. Robert Oppenheimer at a garden party in Margaret's grandparents' backyard in 1938, and within a year had become Kitty Oppenheimer. Tolestrup, Barnes, Whaling, Davis, and Tombrello were professors in Kellogg Lab. Jerry Wasserberg was the Caltech geologist, famous for his analysis of the first Apollo mission moon rocks. He was a difficult character, often battling Frank on trivial issues while Frank was at Caltech. In my other life, as a graduate student, I was enrolled in lecture courses given by Fowler, nuclear astrophysics, Feynman, particle physics, and Thorne, general relativity. From time immemorial, Willie had scheduled his course at the rude hour of 8 a.m. In compensation, the course was ungraded. Feynman was legendary as a lecturer. He made the most complex material so clear that you stopped taking notes. How could you ever forget things that were now so obvious? It was illusion. Half an hour later, you couldn't reconstruct from memory anything he had done. Once I realized this, I took notes whether I needed to or not. Kip didn't have Dick's flair, but he was a clear and conscientious lecturer. His course was the most important for me because I wanted to become his thesis student. For a while, I was doing quite badly in it. Not only that, since my independent project on gravitational wave detectors was winding down, to be resuscitated only if Tombrello decided to do the experiment, which he never did, Kip had been suggesting to me small, mathematical research problems for me to cut my teeth on. I was making no progress on any of them. I was depressed, with days that I could barely drag myself to class or to my shared office desk. Kip may have sensed my feelings of inadequacy. Perhaps to give my ego a boost, he scheduled me to give a talk to the whole research group on gravitational wave detection, a subject on which he knew I felt comfortable. He picked a date when the eminent Princeton professor John A. Wheeler would be visiting. Wheeler was Kip's own thesis advisor, and, years earlier, had been Feynman's. More than the usual number of first-year graduate students attended my talk, perhaps because my title was more understandable than most. Along with Kip and John Wheeler, several other faculty were there. Wheeler, a slightly stooped gentleman with a tired expression, borrowed a piece of paper to write down the names of all the students whom Kip introduced him to. I started my talk with a kind of true-false quiz on common misconceptions about Joseph Weber's apparatus. This unmistakably bombed. I jumped forward to my main material. Whenever I needed to write an important formula, there was no room left for it on the blackboard. Whenever I needed to refer to an equation, I had already erased it. 10 minutes into the talk, Wheeler leaned back and shut his eyes. Thereafter, when he occasionally awakened and looked at the board, there was a look of horror in his eyes, apparent even as his lids sank languorously down again. Polite applause normally followed talks to the group. My final words instead triggered a turbulent stampede for the door. Wheeler remained back from the general melee and gave the blackboard a final long glance, then a final look in my direction. Not horror, it seemed like pity. Richard Price, one of Kip's advanced students, made a point of telling me, later that afternoon, that it was a good talk. "Really," he added, unconvincingly, And you finished early, he said, also approvingly. This seemed a variant of the old joke. The food in that restaurant is terrible. Not only that, but the portions are so small. With the perspective of decades, I think that, apart from poor blackboard technique, mine was actually a good presentation, but in ways that I didn't then understand, it was poorly matched to its audience. Physicists don't all think with the same style. There are different dialects. My dialect, although still unformed, already bore the strong imprint of Ed Purcell, plus a bit of Edward Teller in that circle. Purcell's style was, first, to simplify to the simplest cases that preserved the phenomenon of interest. Second, to reason with pictures, diagrams, and instinct until you developed some physical intuition about the phenomenon. And only then, third, to tease out of that intuition what necessarily had to be the governing equations, and then their solutions. Kipp's style was to go as directly as possible from the phenomenon to the equations, however complex they might be, and only then, when the most general case was mathematically well formulated, to look for the necessary simplifications. If Feynman had been at my talk, he might have liked it. He could have translated it for Kipp and Wheeler. Feynman could speak all the physics dialects. Kipp and Wheeler, along with Charles Misner, another former student of Wheeler's, were at the time writing what became a monumental textbook on general relativity, gravitation, still today in print after almost 50 years. A couple of months later, when I first saw a draft of the chapter on gravitational waves, I recognized its general approach as taken from my talk. I was even credited by name for unpublished work. Kipp was a stickler for always giving credit, and, on this particular subject, he had absorbed from me a Purcell-style approach. Kipp had then convinced Wheeler to throw out their previous less intuitive and more mathematical chapter draft and substitute his new one. A more effective boost to my ego was being sent by Kipp, along with two of his advanced students, to the 6th Annual Texas Symposium on Relativistic Astrophysics, held in Austin just before academic Christmas vacation. Relativistic astrophysics, a very new specialty, included the study of some things that actually existed, high-energy cosmic rays, pulsars, quasars, and some things that theorists only hoped existed, black holes and gravitational waves most prominently. The first Texas conference had been organized the year after quasars were discovered in 1964. Kipp insisted that his students be on a strict budget and that we not overspend our cash travel advances. To save on cab fare, Cliff Will, Bernie Schutz and I slipped onto the Terrace Motel's courtesy bus along with the conference participants actually staying there. It was not the best idea. They tried to make us register at the front desk before they would release our luggage. We executed an operation to distract the bus driver and bellman, spirit our suitcases out of the bus, and sneak across the street to our Austin Motel salesman welcome. These were lodgings for the lower classes, graduate students. Bill Kaufman, the sole astronomer at the largely token Griffith Park Observatory in L.A., and, surprisingly, Caltech professor Jim Gunn, who had brought along his wife, Rosemary, and was penny-pinching. The rooms were actually pleasant, with even-color TV. I hardly minded chasing a 2-inch cockroach down the bathtub drain. The conference was a mostly young crowd, new PhDs and assistant professors. I met for the first time many people whom I would come to know well. Some, like Martin Rees and Stephen Hawking, would become famous. Stephen at this time was primarily known for his work with the more senior Roger Penrose, proving that in some circumstances, the formation of black holes was unavoidable. Hawking would be dead by the time a Nobel Prize was awarded to Penrose for this work. Martin Rees soon enough became known as the leading theoretical astrophysicist of his my generation. Although when I first met him, Martin was a radical leftist and scornful of establishment trappings of authority, he over time became Sir Martin Rees in 1992 and then Baron Rees of Ludlow in 2005. He was president of the Royal Society from 2005 to 2010, also serving as the Queen's Astronomer Royal. At this conference, Stephen's condition was already evident. He could speak, though haltingly, and could walk with difficulty on two crutches. He was just starting to rely on a wheelchair. Others, never famous to the public, were, or became, leading relativists. Kipp's co-author Charlie Misner, Peter Bergman, who had worked with Einstein, Igor Novikov, co-author with Zeldovich of the book I had copy-edited, Yavuz Nutku, a literal young Turk who had just completed his PhD, with the famous Chandrasekhar in Chicago, Lou Witten, my helpful communist Livermore office mate, Bill Unruh, Craig Wheeler, Ken Nordvet, Gary Gibbons. I went out drinking every night with varying combinations of these people. Novikov, a small man, had an astounding capacity for vodka. He was famous for this even in the USSR. Nutku the Turk discovered in himself, when drunk, a new histrionic command of heavily accented English and became a bottomless fount of anecdote. Kip introduced me more formally to the senior eminences Greases who were invited speakers at the conference: Penrose, Tommy Gold, Cornell, Bob Dicke, Princeton, Frank Lowe, University of Arizona, Iosif Shklovsky, Moscow, Frank Drake, Cornell. Charles Townes, MIT, was someone I already knew via my father. Dick was famous for not discovering the cosmic microwave background in 1964. He had been beaten out, some thought in an unsportsmanlike way, by Arno Penzias and Bob Wilson at Bell Labs. Among experimental physicists, Dicke was famous for having invented the lock-in amplifier, also called the Dick switch. The basic idea was to measure very small effects by switching them on and off at a known frequency, which could then be selectively and precisely amplified. At a later conference in honor of Dick, Ed Purcell, who had worked closely with Dick on radar at MIT during World War II, suggested that the way to measure a person's lifetime contribution to the world was to switch them in and out of history 20 times a second, and then observe what in the world was flickering. With some famous people, the few things they are famous for would flicker a lot, but everything else would remain steady. For others, including Dicke, in Purcell's telling, everywhere you looked, many different things would be flickering faintly. Dicke and Purcell died within a week of each other in 1997. At this 1970 conference, Dicke's obsession was the ablateness of the sun. With Karl Brands, he had developed an alternative theory to Einstein's general relativity. If the core of the sun were rapidly rotating, then the famous observation of the orbit of Mercury that confirmed Einstein's theory would be invalid, and the Brands-Dicke theory might instead be confirmed. A rapidly rotating core would produce a very slight oblateness in the observed figure of the sun. Dicke was attempting to make that measurement. The Brands-Dicke theory was decisively disproved in 1982 by precision observations of the orbit of the so-called binary pulsar, two relativistic neutron stars in close orbit. That and related work won the 1993 Nobel Prize in Physics for Joseph Taylor and Russell Hulse. Drake and Shklovsky were in 1970 known for trying to make the search for distant extraterrestrial intelligence using radio telescopes a respectable field of astronomy, SETI. Theirs was a mission never completely achieved. I came back from the conference having learned some science, but more significantly, having gotten a sense of the international community that I was in training to join. That was Kip's intent, probably. When I turned in my accounting to the secretary in Kellogg Lab with $10 of my advance unspent, she told me to keep the money. Chapter 19. Black Holes. This is what we knew about black holes as purely theoretical constructs in 1971. We knew that there were certain mathematical solutions of the equations of general relativity that behaved like massive bodies, but paradoxically contained no matter. These were the so-called vacuum solutions discovered by Karl Schwarzschild in 1915 and Roy Kerr, a New Zealander working at the University of Texas at Austin, in 1963. What set Kerr's vacuum solution apart was that it behaved as if it had not just mass, but also rotation. If you find the idea of a rotating vacuum confusing, so did many physicists at the time. Both the Schwarzschild and Kerr solutions exhibited event horizons, boundary surfaces from within which no material, no light, no signal could escape to the outside. In 1967, John Wheeler coined a name for things with this property: black holes. One way to think about a black hole is that its gravitational pull is so strong that its escape velocity exceeds the velocity of light, so neither light nor anything else can escape. The term black hole is a virtual Rorschach test for dirty minds. Was John Wheeler, in coining it, blind to all its possible innuendos? No, I don't think so. Wheeler's ability at deadpan humor rivaled that of Buster Keaton. He wore the guise of a perfect gentleman, but his straight-faced absurdities often involved pricking the sensibilities of the establishment. When Werner Israel and others proved that black holes must have the unornamented structure of the Schwarzschild or Kerr solutions and nothing additional, Wheeler memorably summarized their results as, "Black holes have no hair." Even today, these results are called no-hair theorems. As a young man in 1930, while on the boat from India to England, the prodigy Chandrasekhar proved that stars more massive than 1.4 times the mass of the sun that exhausted their nuclear fuel, as all stars must eventually do, had no alternative but to collapse. No stable cold configuration existed. We will meet an older Chandrasekhar soon. But collapse to what? The answer was obscure until work by J. Robert Oppenheimer and a student in 1939 connected something real, a star, to something mathematical, the Schwarzschild solution. A gravitationally collapsing star, if it was spherical and not rotating, would in fact become a Schwarzschild black hole. The matter would be lost and ultimately obliterated inside the event horizon. After Roy Kerr's discovery, it was presumed, but not known, that the collapse of a rotating star would produce a Kerr black hole. Black holes, if they formed, were thought to be static objects, frozen, eternal, and unchanging. In Russian, the term for black hole was not the literal Chernaya Dyra, which was vetoed by Zeldovich because he thought it obscene, but Zamershaya Zvezda, frozen star. The idea that a black hole could be perturbed and that it might react to such a perturbation by emitting gravitational waves was not thought of. It was a momentary blind spot in science. Blind spots like this allowed graduate students like me to make their first scientific discoveries. The equations for such a perturbed Schwarzschild solution had been partially worked out by John Wheeler and the Italian mathematical physicist Tullio Rege long before, in 1957. Perhaps because the subject was so abstract and the term black hole had not yet been invented, completing the equations was put aside for 13 years. It wasn't until 1970 that Wheeler offhandedly suggested that a former student of his at Michigan State University, Frank Zirilli, finish the work. Kip took note of Zirilli's success, and he assigned to his student Richard Price the job of figuring out whether the now finally complete Reggie-Wheeler-Zirilli equations could be used to demonstrate anything useful about black holes. In this connection, Kip one afternoon summoned Richard and me to his office. Jim Bardeen, a young professor at the University of Washington, had given a talk somewhere about how gravitational waves might be produced by objects falling into a black hole. Small objects, asteroids say, might, according to Bardeen, produce high-frequency gravitational waves, the kind that Weber claimed to see when they fell into black hole produced by the collapse of a star. Kip had inherited from Wheeler a liking for making up names for things, and he called this the Bardeen dimple conjecture. Kip wanted Richard and me, but mostly Richard, to prove the conjecture using the Reggie-Wheeler-Zirilli equations. By implication, he also wanted Richard to take over my tutelage. Kip was, I think, tired of suggesting to me small mathematical research problems that I was unable to do on my own. Perhaps I would do better as Richard's assistant. Richard Price was more mathematical than I was. He had mastered the currently in vogue Newman-Penrose formalism, yes, that Penrose, and used it to simplify the Reggie-Wheeler-Zirilli equations. The result was still not in a form that could be solved with pencil and paper, the way mathematicians and mathematical physicists then did their work. Richard hoped to make progress by finding limiting cases and approximations, and then piecing together a final result. I said, "Why don't I just solve your equation on the computer and see if Bardeen is right?" "Can you really do that?" "Yes." My optimism was naive, but not unfounded. Hacking at Harvard had made me unafraid of computers, even as most scientists still regarded them as the esoteric realm of professional programmers. And I had, from Livermore, the Wilson LeBlanc pencil notes, my own private, unclassified but do not copy tutorial on how to turn physics into computer code. The program I wrote was very primitive by any modern standard, but the answer that it gave was unequivocal. The Bardeen dimple conjecture was wrong. Gravitational waves were produced, all right, but their frequency and shape had very little to do with what we, on the computer, dropped into the black hole. Instead, they seemed to be properties of the hole itself. The black hole was like a bell, with its own tones and overtones, independent of what object was used to strike it. This wasn't much of a mathematical discovery. The Reggie Wheeler-Zirilli price equations were handed to me on a platter. But it was a paradigm shift to a view that black holes should be thought of as dynamic objects that responded to perturbations as a bell does to being struck. It took Kip several months to come around to my point of view. He still wanted the black hole to be a static object. But he eventually did, and later wrote a whole book on the subject. And I was invited to give a talk to the whole of Kellogg Lab. This one went much better than my previous talk to the Relativity Group. My paper, submitted to the Astrophysical Journal, was initially rejected by an anonymous reviewer. His many objections basically all came down to, everyone knows that black holes are static objects. I wrote a rebuttal, and Kip wrote a heated letter to the journal editor. The paper was eventually published as Long Wave Trains of Gravitational Waves from a Vibrating Black Hole. It should have been my first paper, but by the time it came out, it was my third. Kip's graduate students never knew in advance how much would be required for their PhD theses. Kip's idea was that we should work as if we were already scientists performing research and writing scientific papers. At some point, he would decide, seemingly arbitrarily, that you had done enough. You would at that point schedule your final oral PhD defense, a formality, and get your degree. If this happened at the wrong time of the academic year for you to have applied for jobs, then Kip would come up with a short-term postdoctoral appointment in his group. This transition occurred for Richard Price mid-spring. Richard was Kip's fifth PhD student. With his previous four, Kip had established the tradition of an all-night celebration party at his rambling Altadena home. It was a Friday night. Margaret and I already had tickets to a performance at Beckman Auditorium by The Committee, a San Francisco political comedy troupe, so it was after midnight when we arrived at Kip's. I pointed out to Margaret the notables, Jim and Rosemary Gunn, Virginia Trimble and visiting Martin Rees, who seemed to be together, Richard, of course, who was already quite far gone, Jizzy Bichak, Jim Bardeen, Paul Schechter, Phil Callahan, Rolf Sinclair from NSF. Jizzy was then a genial Czech postdoctoral fellow. Because of Kip's warm relations with the Zeldovich Group in Moscow, scientists from behind the Iron Curtain were frequently allowed out to visit us. Jizzy later became a professor at Charles University in Prague and president of the Czech Academy of Sciences. I had first met fellow graduate student Paul Schechter when we sat next to each other at the placement exams, our first week at Caltech. He looked like a bearded lumberjack. I was impressed at his having been a leader in the radical SDS chapter at Cornell. Richard passed out at about 2:30. At 3, Kip, Bernie, Jim Gunn, and Jim Bardeen had their Russian-style vodka drinking contest. It was not a knockout since they ran out of vodka after only 8 ounces each. To my mind, Gunn, a Texan, won on points. Kip, pretty far gone, approached Margaret and said, leering, "You know something? Your husband is a damn good physicist, but don't tell him I said so." With that, we resolved to stay for the endgame. At 4:30 a.m., there were us, Gunn and wife, Kip, Linda, and a weird male undergraduate. Richard was asleep in the den, and the undergraduate's girlfriend was out cold on the living room couch. Kip talked with Margaret in Russian. Normally, he got this drunk only in Russia, so this made a kind of sense. He asked, in English, my permission to kiss Margaret, saying that the precedent was well established in the case of all his other married grad students. He assured me this was merely a request, not a requirement for my degree. Gunn was entirely in physical control of himself, but every time someone said something to him, he giggled uncontrollably. We left when Linda Thorne was serving coffee to everyone except the undergraduate, who was popping some blue pills. "Try them," he offered to us. "The high lasts about 6 hours." We declined with thanks. Jim Bardeen, whom I came to know well and wrote several papers with, was the son of John Bardeen. The father was one of four people to ever win 2 Nobel Prizes and the only one to win 2 in physics. Jim, far more than I, bore the burden and advantage of having a famous scientist father. As a graduate student at Caltech, Jim had worked with Dick Feynman and Willie Fowler. A few days after the party at Kip's, he wandered into my office. He didn't say anything, just, with a pleasantly quizzical expression, started examining all the papers on my desk and looking at the books in my bookcase. After a few minutes of his doing this, I felt obliged to say something. He was actually easy to communicate with when he talked. Eventually, he wandered out without a goodbye. The episode struck me as more than a little strange. Sometime later, when I met Jim's wife, Nancy, she told me that Jim was the talkative one in the Bardeen family. She described visits to her in-laws. John Bardeen might be sitting alone in the living room. Jim would wander in and sit in a chair facing his father. The two would look at each other. 10 or 15 minutes would pass with neither saying anything. Finally, Jim would say, hi, Dad. That made him the talkative one. Bardeen was a far better mathematician than I was. We worked together on a topic related to Richard Price's work, the so-called Newman-Penrose conserved quantities. Frequently, we talked about an approach in the morning, and I spent the rest of the day struggling to calculate its first steps. At the end of the day, Jim wandered back in, and naturally, without saying anything, put his completion of the calculation in front of me, let me read it, and then took it away. I wondered whether I should ask him to let me Xerox his notes. I described my situation to Margaret by analogy. Mr. Hemingway, may I copy your short story manuscript and submit it, under my name, to my high school literary magazine, Nouvelle Esprit? Margaret only suggested that Cornucopia would be a better name for a high school literary magazine. However, I began to notice that what Jim worked out were often my original suggestions for how to proceed. This was an important self-discovery. I was okay, but not great, at higher applied math. I was much better at strategy, charting a mathematical course through an otherwise confusing research problem. Jim was the first of many superior mathematical collaborators with whom I worked, some older than me, some younger, some my own students. It became the pattern of my scientific career. Chapter 20. Feynman Caltech's stars in physics were Dick Feynman and Murray Gell-Mann, both Nobel laureates. Both were New Yorkers. Murray's father had added the hyphen to the family name. Each cultivated a larger-than-life public persona. Each was a prima donna in a different way. Dick presented himself as a salt-of-the-earth Joe Sixpack, a guy who went to topless bars after work and who liked nothing better than puncturing the hot air balloon of any person the slightest bit pompous. That person, of course, would be Murray, who presented as a hyper-correct pedant, someone who knew everything about everything and would deign to educate the willing listener at any length, but, even better, the unwilling one. Dick and Murray hated each other, had offices next to each other, and made a show of very publicly consulting each other on deep matters of physics, really only when the instigator thought that he would prove himself, again, smarter than the other. Dick's theater of self was the more winning. People, including Margaret and me, loved the Feynman show, and we even liked the man himself. Murray was widely disliked. When Margaret began working on her PhD thesis in linguistics on the Kemiwavy Indian language, Murray, at a Caltech party, impressed her by mentioning that the city Cucamonga in San Bernardino County was a Chemiwavy word. He was mistaken. The word is of Gabrielino origin, meaning that it was in use by the indigenous coastal population around the San Gabriel Mission when the Spanish first settled there in 1771. The Chemiwavys lived in the eastern Mojave Desert and likely came there by 19th century forced migration from even farther east. When Feynman died in 1988, Murray wrote a lengthy and quite nasty obituary for Physics Today. Feynman surrounded himself with a cloud of myth, and he spent a great deal of time and energy generating anecdotes about himself. Both were equally guilty of this. Dick just did it better, and Murray could never forgive him. It was rumored that there was an even nastier version of Murray's obituary that Physics Today had declined to publish. By the summer of 1971, Jim Bardeen had pretty much taken over our Newman-Penrose conserved quantities project and had produced some beautiful results that we were writing up together. I did feel that I had contributed to the project, enough to share the thrill of it anyway. I related to Kip my amazement at it all falling so neatly into place after it had made no sense at all for 6 months. He told me to savor the feeling. It was rare, even for good scientists. He then changed the subject slightly. What do you think about Bardeen horning in on your problem? I responded that it wouldn't make sense for me to artificially keep Jim from doing calculations that he could do much better than I could. Well, you better work something out with him, Kip said, because I don't want you to end up thinking that you've gotten the shaft. The negotiation with the laconic Bardeen took about 30 seconds. How about you be first author, he said. Kip felt that this was an acceptable solution. In the end, I did a lot of the writing. More accurately, Kip did, because he insisted on seeing every draft that I wrote and returned each completely rewritten between the lines in his red ballpoint pen. Drafts in these days before computers were cut-and-paste affairs. Jim wrote his parts out longhand. I typed mine. I had just bought my first used IBM Selectric typewriter, the kind with the little removable type ball, and filled in the equations by hand. I noticed that Kip made very few corrections to Jim's sections. Did he really think that Jim was a better writer than I, or was this mere professional courtesy to a colleague? To find out, I began retyping Jim's sections as if I had written them, and they came back from Kip completely rewritten in red pen. I learned scientific writing from Kip. A lesson he drummed into all his students was related to the tree that falls in the forest with no one to hear. You haven't actually discovered anything, Kip would say, until you have successfully communicated it to others. Still, when Kip inserted extravagant John Wheelerisms, I removed them. Because he was going to be traveling all summer, including to Moscow, Kip made us each write down what we intended to accomplish while he was gone. I wrote that I would calculate with numerical precision the gravitational radiation produced by dropping a small particle into a non-rotating black hole, the RWZ equations again, and added orally that I wanted to start thinking about the more interesting features of rotating Kerr black holes. Just a few months previously, Roger Penrose had surprised the relativity community by showing theoretically that even though a Kerr hole was by definition black, you could contrive to get energy out of it. The Penrose process involved putting a particle into orbit very close to, but outside the hole, then having it decay into two particles, one of which went into the hole, the other recoiling away from it. You could arrange things so that the one particle that escaped had more total mass and energy than the particle that you originally sent into orbit. The extra energy came from the rotation of the hole, which slowed down a bit. I figured that if you could do this with particles, you could surely also do it with waves, maybe with gravitational waves. I talked my idea around the group using the term superradiance, which I borrowed from laser physics. Charlie Misner, Kip's senior colleague in Maryland, had a similar idea, but he was lost in the thicket of still trying to explain the faulty Weber experiment. Zeldovich in Moscow, I later learned, was thinking along similar lines, and maybe not completely independently of me. Zeldovich's hurriedly written paper proposing black hole superradiance was submitted to a Russian physics journal in July, just after Kip's visit. Kip surely would have told him about my work. With lasers, superradiance goes hand in hand with spontaneous emission. That was what I was really interested in finding out. Would a Kerr black hole start spontaneously emitting gravitational waves, losing rotational velocity until it turned itself into a non-rotating Schwarzschild black hole? Would this happen gradually, or in one giant unstable belch of gravitational radiation? In summary, was the Kerr black hole stable? I was to spend much of the next 2 years working on this question. Richard Price had accepted an assistant professor offer at the University of Utah, and Jim Bardeen was soon going back to Seattle, so I badly needed a new mathematical partner. Paul Schechter was sharing a graduate student office with a first-year student from South Africa, Saul Tukulski, who already had a reputation for being mathematical. South Africa, that was very exotic. Saul was obviously not black, so I assumed that he must be Afrikaans, that is, of Dutch lineage. No, he told me he was Jewish. Jews in South Africa tell the story of the two brothers from the shtetl outside Minsk. The older brother emigrates to New York and then writes for his younger brother to join him. Make your way to the harbor at Riga and get on a ship that says USA. The brother complies and ends up in the Union of South Africa. I started bringing papers to Saul for us to discuss together. Often, he was bothered by the lack of mathematical rigor in a proof, which for me was rigorous beyond comprehension. Then, I showed him some computer exercises that I did to check the paper's final result. From my point of view, I thought I was checking my computer program against a demonstrated solution. Saul could not imagine anyone doing numerical solutions so readily, and I could not conceive of anyone being comfortable with the horrendous mess of equations in the paper. This was the germ of our lifelong mutual admiration society. Feynman had announced in class that he was going to give individual oral final exams to every student, 10 minutes each. What kind of exam could take just 10 minutes? "Mr. Press," he said, leaning out of his office when I arrived at 4 on the dot. I went in. He shut the door. Now the spider has caught the fly, his amusement at this joke undiminished on its 14th repetition. I stood at the blackboard, and he asked the first question. When I got 5 words and 1 or 2 chalk symbols into my answer, he interrupted with the next question. Then similarly for the third. I complained that he was not letting me actually answer the questions. "Oh, you think I don't know exactly what you were going to say?" He got up from his chair with a sarcastic show of effort and went to the blackboard. "You were going to say this, and then this, and then this." He was exactly right. After that, I decided to relax and just enjoy not answering the questions. At the end, he said offhandedly, "You get a B." He must have seen my disappointment because he added, "It's not an ordinary B, it's a Dick Feynman B. You go out there and be proud of it." Saul Tucholsky, whose help I needed if I was going to work on Kerr, left for the summer to South Africa. He was going to marry his college sweetheart, Rosalyn, and bring her with him back to Pasadena in the fall. I had no choice but to work my other promise, dropping a particle on the computer into a Schwarzschild black hole. It dawned on me only gradually that this was quite a different kind of undertaking from my previous work. My main results on vibrating black holes were conceptual. I was pretty sure I did the calculations correctly, but it was obvious from the structure of the equations that my main conceptual conclusions were right. My work with Bardeen on the Neumann-Penrose constants was bulletproof in a different way. It was all equations. No computer modeling was involved. After Jim and I both checked every step enough times, we could be pretty sure that the paper was correct. Dropping a particle was different. There would be a numerical answer. How much energy was produced in gravitational waves? I knew that at least 2 others were working on the same problem: Jim Ipser, a former student of Kipps in Chicago, and Rimmo Ruffini, an assistant professor under John Wheeler in Princeton. I wanted to be first with the answer, but I had to get it right. If Ipser or Ruffini got a different numerical answer, and if theirs turned out to be right, my developing reputation as a computational physicist would be destroyed. As a warm-up exercise, I tried to duplicate Zirilli's derivation of his equations and got a discrepant minus sign on one term. That scared me. If someone else's typographical error led to the wrong answer, I would still get the blame. Physicists are supposed to check everything that goes into their work. That is how the field advances. Richard Price was still around, luckily. Richard, a direct and opinionated person who often functioned as group leader in Kipp's absence, was not, I already understood, a brilliant physicist. But he had an excellent understanding of how equations connected to reality. He was a meticulous and accurate calculator, and most importantly, he could not be coerced into agreeing with something that he wasn't himself 100% sure of. He agreed to collaborate. We divided the task into pieces, and then the pieces into smaller pieces, and we spent hours arguing about each tiny step, sometimes conceptually, sometimes about whether we had the equations correct, sometimes about my computer program. We both checked and rechecked everything. It took all summer. Eventually, we had a result. The number, in appropriate units, was 0.0104. That value was not large, but it was 4 to 6 times larger than previous crude estimates. By the time that Kipp was back in town, we had the draft of a paper to submit to Physical Review Letters. Richard took it on himself to call both Jim Ipser, whom he knew well, and Rimmo Ruffini, whom he had met just once or twice, to tell them that we had a result and were submitting a paper. It was a polite way of saying, "We won." Jim took the news with good grace. Rimmo, not so. He had finished his calculation months ago, he said. He had merely put off writing it up while he was vacationing in Italy with his mistress, he said. Surely that should not count against his claim for priority over us. Richard told him our answer, 0.0104, and asked what answer he got. Within 10% of ours, he said. Later in the same phone call, it became within 1% of ours. We weren't sure we believed him. Kip was visiting John Wheeler at his cottage on High Island in South Bristol, Maine. The handful of houses on the island shared a single phone line, and it took us an hour to get through. Rimmo may be difficult, Kip said, but he is not dishonest, adding that John Wheeler and he would together decide the question of who got to publish first. What eventually happened, after much agitazione e emozione, was that a joint paper, almost identical to Richard's and my first draft, was published with four authors, Davis, Ruffini, Press, and Price. This was not a happy experience for me. Co-author Davis was Mark Davis, a Princeton graduate student who soon quit working with Rimmo and became an observational astronomer and later a colleague and friend of mine at Harvard. Mark and I were never able to compare old timelines down to the day, but a guess is that the truth was this. Mark was making progress on the problem, but with as yet no reliable result. Rimmo claimed to us that they already had the answer, and he then spun up Mark into high gear. Mark's computer program did then genuinely produce the same answer as ours, but it did so only after he, or at least Rimmo, had in hand not just our answer, but our whole draft paper. Mark could not have believed his program without our result. He had no Richard Price to check his every step. Ruffini was a thorn in the side of the relativity community for several more years, leaving in his wake a growing list of people who felt that he had abused them. Kip eventually wondered if his earlier assessment of Rimmo might have been too charitable. I never heard such an admission from John Wheeler, but by 1975, Wheeler seemed to have cut his ties with Ruffini and, to my knowledge, never again published with him. When I became an assistant professor at Princeton in 1974, I was filling the slot that Ruffini had vacated to go back to Italy, where he spent the rest of a long career.